Welcome to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM from April 4th, 2001.
From the high desert and the great American Southwest, I bid you all good evening and or good morning, wherever you may be across this great land of ours, from the island of Guam in the west, sort of west, I mean it's across state line, maybe it's east, I don't know, eastward to the Caribbean and the U.S. Virgin Islands, south into South America, north all the way to the pole. This is Coast to Coast AM and I'm Art Bell. Cheerio. Lots to talk about tonight. Lots and lots to talk about tonight. But first, I guess I better do what I'm supposed to do first, right? Welcome, KXYL in Brownwood, Texas. There are 1240 on the dial. Glad to be on the air in Brownwood as we continue to screech now toward 500 affiliates nationwide on the network. Glad to have you on board. We're gonna break some news for you in this first hour. It has sort of begun to leak out in some other news media earlier in the day, but not a one of them have got the complete story. Tonight here, you will in the first hour, you will get the complete story. It has to do with chemtrails. And boy, have we got some big news for you in that category. So stay tuned for that coming up here in a few moments. Last night, I mentioned Echo Challenge. I don't know if any of you have seen that. As you know, I'm a fan of Survivor on TV, and Echo Challenge is Survivor times 10,000, easily times 10,000. I mean, this is really rough stuff. It also took place, the one I'm referring to in Borneo, and holy man, I mean, these people were picking leeches out of places where you didn't even think leeches would want to go. They were going over terrain that no human being should ever have to go over. They were suffering injury that no human being, short of supermen and women, which these were, could sustain and keep going. If you want to see Echo Challenge, it's going to be on the USA Radio Network, the USA Network on TV. These are Eastern times. Check your own TV guide to see when it's on locally. Sunday, you can catch the whole thing. It'll be on at 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 o'clock in the afternoon Eastern times. That'd be the preferred time to catch it. Then next Tuesday, I think they're going to do a recap, two-hour recap. But if you want to catch the whole thing, and it's worth catching, why any human being would ever go through this escapes me totally. I'm in the middle of, I haven't watched the whole thing yet. I'll see the last couple of episodes, I think, tonight when I finish my air shift. So mark that down, USA Television, Eastern Times, on Sunday, April 8th, 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 o'clock in the afternoon. It's a real mind-blower. It's something past reality TV. And one of the, by the way, one of the teams that went in the Echo Challenge, and I know you're not going to believe this, was a team of three Playboy centerfold bunnies. And so you say, oh, yeah, right. Well, right. This is really extreme sports. I mean, really, really extreme. And I had a listener who happened to know one of these bunnies, and so I got in contact with one of the bunnies, and now I think I'm in contact with three of the bunnies, and we might have them on. They did remarkably well in the Echo Challenge. You cannot imagine how difficult this thing is until you see it. That's why I'm urging you to see it. We'll probably book these gals on the show to talk about what they did. My God, it was incredible. In my opinion, anybody who would do that has to be completely, has to have lost their mind. In fact, you've got to pay to get into it. It's put on by Barnett, the same guy who does Survivor. But this one, they ought to call it Borneo Death on a Stick. Incredible. So we'll see. Maybe we'll get somebody booked on the show or several somebodies. So there is that. Let me see. Is there anything else that I must get on before we get deep? Remember, during the Nixon years, remember Deep Throat? Well, we've got Deep Sky. That's right, Deep Sky, as it relates to chemtrails. And as I said, little wisps of this have made it out on other media, but only here will you hear, and for the first time, the complete story from Deep Sky. That's coming up here shortly. The airplane still on the island in China. Actually, Drudge was running a story earlier saying China's hinting it might put the crew of an American spy plane on trial as tension over the grounding and seizure of the aircraft grew. They put them on trial, and then we do have a problem. So I would imagine they would avoid doing that. The Clinton administration offering a chorus of regrets but no apology for what happened. And it's all still at a stalemate. All right, there you have at least the open. I've got so much more I've got to get to you, but what I'm about to give you from a reporter in New Hampshire and from Will Thomas takes precedence over the rest of what I'm going to do right now. It's breaking news. It has to do with chemtrails, and trust me, you don't want to miss it. Coming up immediately next. Well, we're going to call this report Operation Deep Sky, I guess. First of all, you know him very well. Will Thomas, are you there?
I'm here.
Okay, a reporter, a journalist. He's been on to this chemtrail thing for how long now, anyway?
2 years and 3 months, and I could probably give you the hours and minutes.
That's all right. 2 years, and that's a long time, and
that's
you've done
a
number of shows here. There's a young lady back east in New Hampshire named Tiffany Brent. Is that correct?
D-T.
B-R-E-N-D-T?
Yes.
Okay. Tiffany, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Art.
You are a reporter, news person, radio person. You work for what station back there?
I work for WLKZ, Oldies 105, as a disc jockey, and I also do news, weather, and sports. Isn't that fun?
Yes, actually. It's all right. So you've been in the media for how long, Tiffany?
8 years. But I also do freelance reporting, and my items air on another radio station, WMWV, which is out of Conway, New Hampshire.
All right. How long have you been a broadcaster?
8 years.
8 years?
Yes.
All right. How did Tiffany meet Will?
On the phone.
On the phone.
And over email.
And over email.
Yes.
I take it, Tiffany, that you have been following the story of chemtrails, these things that look like contrails, only not. They're much more perhaps sinister or different than a normal contrail, usually darker, oily, kind of gooky stuff that spreads through the sky and remains when it ought not. That's a quick description, but how did you get on to this?
Well, initially I had learned about it a couple of years ago and had seen it, I'm sure, many times, didn't even know what I was looking at, but I really got my teeth into it March 12th of this year because we saw an incredibly huge operation in the skies over Maine and New Hampshire, and I just could not believe what I was seeing in
March,
my life.
March 12th, so not even a month ago.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Had you heard about chemtrails on this program, or did you just sort of fall into wondering what it was all on your own?
No, I had heard about it on your program from my partner, Lou Aubuchon, and from someone else that I know named Phil Marie Jr.
Mm-hmm. So you knew what you were looking at.
When I saw it on March 12th, I sure did.
Yeah. All right. So what did you do? Here are these, no doubt, horrid little chemtrails crossing X's, crossing your sky, whatever. What did you do?
Well, I had just literally gotten off the air just a few hours before that, and I wasn't even sure what I was looking at. I had made a comment in fun saying contrail or chemtrail, and Lou happened to look out the window, and he said, "I'm not sure," and we both went outside, and we couldn't believe it. We were seeing, at that point, we had seen 30 jets, not just lines, but 30 jets in 45 minutes. We counted them.
30 jets?
In 45 minutes, from 12:10 p.m. to 12:55 p.m., 30 jets.
That's a lot of jets. Are you're not really, I wouldn't think, in New Hampshire. You'd be over any major air traffic lanes. If you were in New Jersey, New York, somewhere there, I could imagine it. But where you are, I wouldn't think that many jets ought to be flying.
No, and it's not something that we had ever witnessed before, not even Lou, who is ex-military. And I used to live in Mamaroneck, New York, which is just north of New York City.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you know the jet traffic that you would normally see down there. This still wasn't like that. This was very different.
Even greater than that?
Yes.
So I guess with a reporter's curiosity, you decided to do what?
I made several phone calls to various airports that might have air traffic in our area, and finally got a hold of one human being that would actually tell me something of what was going on, but I did have to pull it out of him.
As a matter of fact, we have two tapes that you're going to play tonight.
Yes, we do.
Now, I want to talk about the tapes before we play them, so that people understand what they're hearing. This is going to be, first of all, the tape is going to be altered.
Yes, it is.
The sound is altered. In what manner did you alter the sound?
Well, my voice sounds a little bit different, but the reality of it was that we took his voice out, fiddled around with it, played with pitch control, and then put it back.
So he's going to sound a little unnatural. This is basically to keep this guy from getting fired, right?
Absolutely.
All right. Can you tell us what position this person holds? I don't want to know where he works. How much can you tell me about him without telling me too much?
Well, what I don't tell you, I can't. I'll tell you everything that I can tell you that he has given me permission to say. He is an air traffic control manager.
Air traffic control manager.
Yes. And he works at a major metropolitan airport in the Northeast.
All right. Is he the first person you connected with?
On that day, no.
No. So you had to go fishing around a little bit. What kind of answers did you get from the first people you called?
Well, they wanted to put me through to their superiors, but I was on hold a couple of times, a little bit longer than I like to be on hold, so I just kept dialing. Mostly people wouldn't tell me anything or they didn't know anything.
Hmm. This person that we're going to play the telephone tapes of has given you permission to record his voice.
Yes, actually, both tapes were done in person.
Oh, in other words, he came to your, studios or radio station or what?
Well, he actually made a trip up here. He has a house by a lake. I also have a place by a lake, and this is in Maine right now, by the way. Although I do work in New Hampshire, I have a house on a lake in Maine.
Ah.
And he invited me to interview him there because he felt more comfortable than at that time either going to a radio station or possibly me interviewing him anywhere near any of the airports.
Is this fellow worried about his job if it gets out who he is?
He's worried about his job, and I have had the impression since my first meeting with him that he's worried about more than that.
More than that?
Yes.
As in the health of himself and or his family, that kind of thing?
Yes, that was one of the first things that came out right after the interview. I had asked him, at that time it was off the record, but since I've had permission to say this, if he had experienced or his family had experienced any unusual health concerns or symptoms that they had not had in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, by unusual, do you mean something that the doctors wouldn't know anything about? And I said, no, just something that, say, happened suddenly that you never had happened to you in the past. And he told me that his wife had what he termed as sudden adult onset asthma when she had not even had as much of it as an allergy in the past. And all three of his children suffered from either asthmatic or allergic reactions and very sudden and gushing nosebleeds.
Oh my.
To the point where his infant, his son who's under 2 years old, who I happened to see that day, had to go to the emergency room.
Do you think there is a relationship between these health problems and what he knows? I mean, that would imply they're already not only on to him, but actively disciplining him.
I don't know if that's happened yet because my most recent interview with him was yesterday. So we don't know. I will try and reach him tomorrow, and hopefully I'll be able to hear from him. But I gave him a bone so I could take a bone away. I told him something that had happened to me at a time that I didn't even realize I was taking photographs of chemtrails when I thought I was taking photographs of foliage and the beautiful blue sky that we had.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a couple of years ago. Very shortly after that, I had a gushing nosebleed, and I don't get nosebleeds. And I went to the emergency room at a hospital in New Hampshire. So when I told him that, he also told me that, yes, that's something that has happened to him and his family. He personally has not had a serious nosebleed, although he's had nosebleeds, but nothing like his son.
Which one of the two of you decided to call this fellow Deep Sky?
I believe that was Will, yes.
That was you, Will.
I couldn't resist after Woodford and Bernstein. I guess the journalist in me has always wanted a coup as big as Watergate and Art. We have that thanks to ST tonight.
Uh-huh. Well, did Tiffany call you once she had the first tape? I mean, how did this happen?
Tiffany, go ahead.
Okay. Basically, I think we had been in touch by email first.
That's right.
We do listen to you, Art, both Lou and I, and actually Lou's been listening for longer than I have because I didn't even know who you were for a while. But since we've been listening, we listened to your show on March 14th because we had heard it was going to be about chemtrails and that Will was going to be on. And obviously that was just a couple of days after we had seen the largest operation we'd ever seen. So we did listen, and we contacted Will via chemtrail. And via email about the chemtrails.
Yes.
And then Will had contacted us after that.
Well, Will made a frantic call to me. I don't know, that was a few days ago, Will, and I made reference to it on the air. Will said, I not only have the smoking gun, I've got the smoking bomb. And you had a tape that you were having very great difficulty in playing. You don't have a lot of luck with tape, Will.
Not having a lot of luck with secondhand tape, no.
And so you tried to play it for me and never could. I take it that was the first of the two tapes that we're going to hear tonight. Is that correct?
Yes, it is.
All right. And then there was a second tape that was made, a really critical, important tape that nobody has heard anywhere until tonight, correct?
No one has, except for Will.
Except for Will.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. We got together, Art, on
and
that
you.
One. And put together a list of questions, the two of us, to present to this person that would allow him to answer key and critical questions again without exposing himself.
Well, all right. Do either one of you think that what we're about to do tonight is going to be dangerous for either you or the gentleman who came to you, Tiffany?
I don't know that I would say dangerous, except that if they do figure out it's him, which we've taken great pains to make sure that they cannot figure out that it's him, I think he could lose his job.
And if somebody comes to you with some sort of court order trying to get information on who he is based on what you revealed tonight, what would you do?
I just have terrible short-term memory problems, Art.
Yeah, and you could blame it on chemtrails, too.
I could do that, yes. I joke, but I'm serious.
I know, I understand, believe me. We have speculated, as you know, on the air for a long time about what chemtrails might be. The ugliest theory is that they are virtually testing some sort of germ warfare on us. Then it gets a little less ugly. Maybe they're trying to immunize all of us against something horrible that's out there. And from there, it goes to even lesser things, nevertheless big stories. For example, a control of our weather or an attempt to control our weather. And this tape, once the audience has heard it, is going to answer which of those it is, correct?
Yes.
Do you believe this man?
I believe that he believes that this is what it is because I believe that he was told this. And he does say that this is what he was told. And actually, he was not told it on the 12th.
Did he seem credible to you?
Yes, very.
Credible.
Yes.
All right, an air traffic control manager is about to tell us what these chemtrails are all about. You're going to hear a lot of I'd rather not comment on that kind of deal. And I can't blame him, but that's what's coming up. So both of you hold on, all right?
All right.
I will.
All right. That's the setup for all of this, folks. You're about to get some answers. I'm Art Bell, and this is Coast to Coast AM from the high desert.
You're listening to Art Bell Somewhere in Time, tonight featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from April 4th, 2001.
She's coming in 12:30 flights. The moonlit wings reflect the stars that guide me towards salvation. I stopped an old man along the way, hoping to find some old forgotten words or ancient melodies. He turned to me as if to say, "Hurry, boy, it's waiting there for you.
Covered and then to burst up through tarmac to the sun again, or to fly to the sun without burning a wing, to lie in a meadow and hear the grass sing, to have all these things in our memories haunt, and to use them to help
Somewhere in Time, tonight featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from April 4th, 2001.
Good morning. In a moment, you're going to hear Tiffany Brent along with Will Thomas, but you're going to hear a recording that Tiffany Brent made, a witness who actually came to her, an air traffic control manager whose voice is going to be modified for obvious reasons, who's about to tell you what he thinks he knows or has been told these chemtrails are all about. Stay right there. Well, you never hear that, not with the chemtrails. Good morning, everybody. I'm Art Bell, and here we go. Tiffany Brent is a reporter from New Hampshire who has interviewed an air traffic control manager at one of the major northeast airports in the U.S., Will Thomas, an investigator who's been on this chemtrail thing forever, from a reporting point of view, and trying to get good, hard information. And I think Will believes that Tiffany has good, hard info, don't you, Will?
I do. We've got it tonight, Art.
All right. Let's not hold them, Tiffany. Let's do it. The first tape is just sort of, I guess, a kind of a setup piece for the second tape, right?
Yes, more or less. But there is some information on there that confirmed what we suspected, specifically the military operation.
All right. Let's rock.
Okay.
Here we go, folks. Tape preparation sounds.
For the record, you work at a metropolitan area airport in air traffic control. In fact, you are a federal employee. Is that correct?
Yes.
And I am the journalist and radio personality that spoke with you via phone on Monday, March 12, 2001?
Yes.
Well, I would like to reconstruct our conversation of March 12, 2001 as near to the original as possible, with the exceptions of anything that might identify you, and the addition of a few questions that have since arisen in my mind. Is this agreeable to you?
Yes.
At approximately 12:55 p.m. on Monday, March 12, 2001, I called your airport's air traffic control tower, and I spoke directly with you, correct?
Yes.
I gave you my exact location, which you recognized, and informed you of what seemed to me to be an unusual amount of air traffic visible in our area. In fact, I told you that we were witnessing over 30 jets in less than an hour, mostly flying northeast to southwest, over 30,000 feet, did I not?
Yes.
And what do you remember as your answer?
I have relatives in that area, so I knew where you were calling from and what should be visible to you.
Do you remember telling me in that time span that you had 9 jets in or out of your airspace?
Yes.
Did I ask if you could see all the traffic on your screens that we were witnessing?
Yes, and I told you that we own everything to 10,000 feet, that we filter everything else out. We could see it if we chose to, but we don't unless we have something of our own coming in at that altitude.
And what altitude is that?
Over 30,000 feet.
And what do you remember telling me of international air traffic that would be visible to us, if any?
I said that there is an increase of international flights on Monday, especially in the afternoon, and that you might be seeing international flights coming into Boston or New York.
Did you ask me if I'm usually in this area during the week or just a visitor?
Yes, I thought that you might not be used to the normal amount of air traffic that we have here during the week.
And I told you that I am here every day during the week and sometimes on weekends?
Yes.
So I am used to normal air traffic? Did I insist that this was not normal, that what we were seeing was considerably more air traffic than I can remember seeing here, even in the summer?
Yes.
Didn't I ask how it was that we could see so many jets, and whose air traffic was it if not yours? That is, if you filter out most everything over 10,000 feet?
Yes, and I told you that Boston Center is in Nashua, New Hampshire, also Kennebunk VOR.
Boston Center being another air traffic control center in the Northeast?
Yes, the one that handles a good deal of traffic, including international flights.
And what is Kennebunk VOR?
It's a major navigational aid to international air traffic in the Northeast.
At this point, did I mention that my partner was outside the building, still counting several more jets in the air at the same time as we spoke?
Yes.
And what was your answer to that?
I said that that amount of air traffic in such a short span of time was unusual, even though you would see more international air traffic in the afternoon.
Did you mention to me that you had to reroute some air traffic?
Yes.
And why was that?
We had to bring in a couple in lower. That is, we had 2 from the Northeast that had to come in under their usual altitude. They had to come in at 10,000 feet or under. We had Boston Center take 1.
So if I'm hearing this correctly, on March 12, 2001, you had a reason not to filter out everything over 30,000 feet?
Yes.
So you did see some, and I quote, stepped up activity yourself?
Yes.
Didn't you question that?
No.
Well, why not?
Because I had an explanation for that.
Did someone ask you to reroute your traffic?
Yes.
Who?
I can tell you that I received a call telling me what I had to do.
You mean reroute air traffic?
Yes.
You can't tell me who?
No.
Will you tell me why?
You are sure you'll keep my name and where I work out of it?
Well, you work at a major metropolitan airport in the Northeast in air traffic control. You did agree to allow me to say that.
Yes.
And I gave you my word that that is all I will say.
Okay.
So will you tell me why you were told to reroute your air traffic?
I was told that there was a military exercise in the area.
And did you tell me the military exercise combined with your traffic and international traffic is probably why I was seeing stepped-up activity?
Yes.
And you used the phrase stepped up?
Yes, I probably did.
Did you say, of course, they wouldn't give you any of the particulars and that you don't ask, you just do your job?
Yes, something like that.
Well, since Monday the 12th, have we spoken?
Yes, a couple of times.
To set up this interview?
Yes.
Did I ask if you happened to notice an increase in air traffic on the 12th?
Yes.
And you said?
I did notice a little more than usual, yes.
In the last couple of years, can you recall any other times when you were asked to reroute air traffic?
Just a couple of times, maybe as much as 4 times.
Were you asked to reroute air traffic yesterday or today?
Yes.
Both days?
Well, I'd rather not say both days, but yes, I was.
For the same reason as Monday?
I have to be careful of my job. I have a family to support.
Well, I understand. You have helped me tremendously, and I won't do anything or add anything to the information that you have given me here in this interview today. I will not do anything to compromise the promise of anonymity that I gave you, but will you answer that one last question?
About?
Were you asked to reroute air traffic Tuesday and today for the same reason as Monday, the 12th of March?
Yes.
Thank you again for granting me this interview.
All right. All right, that's interview number 1.
Yes.
And the big information comes in interview number 2, but it all goes to the listeners deciding for themselves the credibility of what they're hearing.
Exactly. And the main reason why that tape was important is that he became curious about the amount of air traffic that I would see. And you'll hear in the second tape how he made a trip up here himself on a Monday to see exactly what we would normally see.
By the way, Tiffany, you'd be real good in depositions.
So I've been told. Thank you.
All right. Let's without delay, I'll tell you, you can hold the phone a little closer or turn up the volume a little bit.
Okay,
let's
we'll
go to the second critical tape. Same man, Second interview, folks.
Yes.
Here we go. Go ahead, Tiffany. Go ahead and put it on. Once again.
And it's April 3rd, and this is a follow-up to the interview of March 21st, 2001, with my deep sky source. We've spoken with each other via phone, and we've met before, correct?
Yes.
When I called you to set up this follow-up interview, did you tell me about a trip you made on March 26, 2001 to my area?
Yes.
Would you tell me about that trip, why you made it, and what you observed?
I wanted to see for myself what air traffic would be visible to you on any given Monday from noon to 1 p.m.
And what did you observe?
I saw one jet flying at approximately 31,000 feet, traveling east to southwest. I also saw two smaller aircraft at much lower altitudes.
Did you mention something about traffic that might be visible to me from our local jetport?
Yes.
And how much traffic would be visible to me of the nine jets in or out of that jetport on March 12th?
Possibly one or two of those jets.
Would any international traffic be visible to me?
Yes, but a small amount.
Not the number of jets that I had witnessed on March 12, 2001?
No.
Which you told me were probably a combination of the military exercise and international traffic?
Yes.
And that was 30-plus jets in 45 minutes from 12:10 p.m. to 12:55 p.m.?
That is what you reported to me, yes.
But you've since proven to yourself that I wouldn't see much international traffic.
Yes.
You also saw a lot of activity on your screen on the 12th. You told me you witnessed stepped-up activity on the 12th, the 20th, and the 21st of March.
Yes.
And this was due to military exercises?
Yes.
Was there considerably more traffic on the 12th than there was on the 20th or the 21st?
Yes.
And would I be able to witness this activity from my location?
Yes.
Is it customary to reroute air traffic for military exercises from your tower? That is, does this occur on a regular basis?
No, not really. Not from my airspace, no.
But it might be from other areas.
That is possible, yes.
Well, is there a reason why you're still worried about your identity? Worried enough to have me alter your voice on the tape?
Yes.
And why is that?
I don't know how much I can tell you that you can record.
You mean this might compromise your identity?
It could.
Oh, I'll let that one go. Did you witness any radar anomalies due to the exercise? That is, was it degraded or maybe enhanced during the operation on March 12th?
Somewhat degraded, yes.
Was radar painting any kind of clutter or cloud in a clear sky?
Yes, there was what you might call a haze.
Would this affect flight safety?
That would depend on the density.
Was safety affected on March 12th, 20th, or 21st, 2001?
Not from my perspective, no.
Did your orders to reroute air traffic come from military personnel?
No.
Did they come from a higher civil authority?
Yes, but I can't tell you who, so please don't ask.
Are you aware of this happening in any other air traffic regions?
Yes.
On the same dates?
Yes, and other dates as well.
Many regions?
I wouldn't say many, no.
Some regions?
Yes.
What regions?
Well, one was south of my location.
Will you tell me where?
I'd rather not.
Were you told the type of aircraft that was involved in the military exercise?
Yes.
Were they tanker-type aircraft?
Yes.
Where did they originate?
I really can't disclose that information. It might identify me.
Okay. To your knowledge, did any aircraft cross into Canadian airspace?
That was what was indicated on my equipment, yes.
On March 12th?
Yes.
Do you know or were you told the nature of the operation?
Only after the fact.
When?
On the 22nd.
Of March?
Yes.
Was this a radar experiment?
Not that I was told.
Was this a weather modification experiment?
That approximates what I was subsequently told, yes.
Will you elaborate on that?
I'd rather not, no.
Okay, well, thank you again for agreeing to this interview, and as I promised, I will not disclose your identity for any reason.
All right, so there it is, weather modification. He said it aloud.
Yes, he did.
Again, all right, Tiffany, two things. One, I joked, I said you'd be good in a deposition, you would. Those questions sounded as though they were absolutely prepared. I mean, you were just boom, 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 right there. Did you have those written up for him before the interview?
I had them written up for me before the interview.
That's right, that's right. Well, in preparation for him.
Yes.
So you knew exactly what you were going to ask.
Yes, I did.
Did he know ahead of time what you were going to ask?
I told him I wouldn't blindside him, that we would discuss... in the first interview, that we would discuss what we had already discussed on the phone when I contacted him at work. In the second interview, I said we're probably
going to... Wait a minute. That's critical. You contacted him at work?
The first time, not in the first interview.
Yes. I understand, but you without question, Tiffany, you spoke to him. You know what you called. You called whatever air traffic control center it is that you called that we're not exposing here.
Exactly.
So you know doggone well he's not a put-on. He's a real employee is what I'm saying.
He's a real employee, absolutely.
Okay. That was very important. Will,
yes.
Comments, what do you make of all this?
I help prepare those questions, and these are key questions. And let's take a second, Art, look a little bit closer. One of the key questions was the radar return. There's been speculation that this was a radar experiment using barium to enhance radar, and we have been able to disprove that with his answer, that it actually degraded performance with a hazy-type clutter on the radar in weather that was a clear blue cloudless sky. That indicates to me very, very fine particulates of aluminum. Talcum powder-type clouds of aluminum would give you that hazy return. So I think mm-hmm. we're really on the right track with our aluminum hypothesis here. And also the fact they've crossed into Canadian airspace makes me particularly angry.
Briefly explain to the audience why aluminum, just in case they didn't hear you the other night.
Sure.
Aluminum, so powdery, is virtual powder, and it actually polishes the engines of aircraft. That's what we were talking about last time. But why the aluminum? What do they think that will do to our weather? What is the theory?
It is the theory put forward by Dr. Edward Teller in the Lawrence Livermore Lab, which actually ran computer models, and the International Panel on Climate Change, which verified these models, says that if you put up 10 million tons of aluminum particulates, very fine particulates, it will reflect up to 1% of incoming sunlight and chill out global warming that is now almost in a runaway condition. Now, the military, of course, have been using aluminum shaft, big tinfoil-sized pieces of aluminum, to jam radars for many years. That's why fine particulates will give a hazy return without interfering to the point where it would degrade
safety.
Oh,
right. So I now see where your preparation of these questions came into play for Tiffany's interview. You wanted to see if there was any degradation of the radar that you believe would be produced and probably would by a powder-type substance, aluminum. So he gave the exact answer that would support that theory.
Yes, he really confirmed that theory. He nailed that down. And here's something that's very important for our listeners tonight. When an agency wants to modify weather, according to NASA, they introduce very, very fine particulates into the atmosphere. These particulates act as nuclei. Water vapor condenses around them. It forms clouds. It forms precipitation. I'd like to go back to Tiffany in just a second and talk about what happened to their weather on and after the 12th. And we're talking fatalities here.
All right, we're very,
as well.
Very short on time. Tiffany, what did happen to the weather?
Well, I can say that after they sprayed on the 12th, we had a very large snowstorm and in mid-March. That's a little unusual for Maine.
Mm-hmm.
But worse yet, since it has become spring, we had two snowstorms that equaled almost 4 feet. So since the 20th, we have had two snowstorms that were quite large.
All right. Tiffany, we've got to begin summing up here. This gentleman, then, we know through you firsthand to be who he says he is.
Yes.
You know that for certain, and at least as far as that goes, you're staking your journalistic reputation on the fact that he is who he says he is, at least that much, right?
Yes, I've called him at work a few times, yes.
Uh-huh. Do you think it likely that he will give you any more? I mean, he flatly said weather modification.
Yes, he did.
Do you think he will give you or knows any further details that he'd be willing to talk about?
We're going to try and find out where they originated. He knows that.
In that interview, Tiffany, did you stop at the point where he said weather modification, or did you probe without success further?
I stopped at that point because I knew that he was getting into an area where he was very nervous. He more than chain-smoked both interviews, and his hands were shaking.
Okay. Will Thomas, other media are going to be interested in this. I think best we give out one set of contact information Will, and why don't you go ahead and give that out so other media can contact you.
Okay, my website with full documentation and an updated press release, lifeboatnews.com. Media can reach me by email, Will Thomas, one word, Will Thomas, at telus, TELUS.net. Art, I've sent out over 100 press releases to major newspapers, radio, magazines throughout the U.S. and Canada. I have gotten one response. I am urging all listeners tonight, go to your local media, local and national media, and insist that they cover this story.
All right. Well, now you've got a little something to cover, at least.
Oh, yes.
Will Thomas, that's W-I-L-L-T-H-O-M-A-S, right?
Yes.
At telus, T-E-L-U-S, dot net.
Correct.
Tiffany, are you going to pursue this with this deep sky, we'll call him?
I will be speaking with him tomorrow morning, first thing.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Are you going to pursue the weather control angle with him and try and find out how much more he knows?
Yes, and I'm also going to try and find out if he does know, which I believe he does, where these jets originated.
Uh-huh.
Art, we're talking the mother of all class action lawsuits, and I'm not kidding. We are in touch with two attorneys as we speak tonight.
Well, then you're probably also in the middle of the mother of all dangerous situations, from my point of view.
No, we've gone public, and that's the safety. I talked with ST earlier today. We were going to sit on this, and I said it's too hot. We're going to go public, and that really is our safety here. I feel under no physical threat whatsoever.
All right. All right, then I want to thank both of you, Will and Tiffany, and we'll look forward to any further follow-up on this, but it's the first person that's ever said anything like that.
Yeah, I've gathered because I could not get any information from anyone else.
Good night, all.
Good night.
Thank you, Art. Thank you, ST.
Thank you.
You're listening to Art Bell Somewhere in Time on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from April 4th, 2001.
And a kid without a cent, get a break and maybe grow up to be president. Only in America, land of opportunity, yeah. Would a classy girl like you fall for a poor boy like me?
I don't want your lonely mansion. Tear in every room. All I want is the love you promise beneath the haloed moon. But you think I should be happy with your money and your name, and hide myself in sorrow while you play your cheating game. Silver threads and golden
presents Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight's program originally aired April 4th, 2001.
In the first hour of this program, you just heard something for the first time. You heard an air traffic control manager at a northeastern facility in the U.S., courtesy of Tiffany Brent and William Thomas, admit for the first time publicly that what they're doing up there with those chemtrails, it's weather control. That's what he said, folks. In a few moments, we're really going to have an interview. Dr. Bart Kosko, Professor Kosko, is here, and he has written a book called Heaven in a Chip. Heaven in a Chip. Now, what do you suppose that means? It says, fuzzy visions of society and science in the digital age. Imagine a world where you could achieve digital immortality in a computer chip. Tell the government how you want it to spend your tax dollars. We'll have to talk about that one. Have a digital intelligent agent as your best friend and your protector from the prying eyes of government and corporations. Design a child, perhaps, that is 40% yours, 40% your spouse's, and 20% someone else's. Yes, sir. Millions are lining up, I'm sure, to do that right now. Create new music from Mozart and new art from Michelangelo. View a fetus as only 36% alive, while viewing an aging person as only 90% dead. Back up your thoughts, your entire brain on a chip the size of a sugar cube. That's what we're going to be talking about with Professor Kosko in just one moment, if you'll be patient and stay right where you are. Heaven in a chip. Bart Kosko is a professor of electrical engineering at the University of Southern California, where he teaches courses on information, science, neural networks, fuzzy logic, digital processing, and where he serves as an elected faculty senator and former director of USC's Signal and Image Processing Institute. Dr. Kosko holds degrees in philosophy, economics, mathematics, electrical engineering, and is an award-winning composer. He is an elected governor of the International Neural Network Society and has chaired and co-chaired several international conferences on neural and fuzzy systems conferences, and is on the editorial board of several scientific and mathematical journals. Dr. Kosko has published over 100 scientific papers, has published several popular essays in venues from Scientific American to the New York Times. Dr. Kosko is author of the new book, Heaven in a Chip, Random House, the international best-selling Fuzzy Thinking, and a novel called Nanotime, a fact-based cyber thriller about what World War III would look like in 2030. Oh, yes, we'll ask about that. Dr. Kosko has authored the scientific textbooks, Fuzzy Engineering, Neural Networks, and Fuzzy Systems, and Neural Networks for Signal Processing, all from Prentice Hall, and the brand new text, Intelligent Signal Processing. The latter text reflects the new field of advanced technology that Dr. Kosko has helped found, ISP, or Intelligent Signal Processing. Dr. Kosko is also one of the fewer than 1,000 people in the world who wears a cryonics bracelet, get this, folks, and who holds a cryosuspension contract to take effect upon his death, or deanimation, if you will. Hence, he is in the experimental group, while about 6 billion other people are in the burn or bury control group, oh my God, of this multi-decade social experiment. There's a lot of material here. Dr. Kosko is on the scientific advisory board of the Alcor Cryonics Foundation, along with MIT artificial intelligence pioneers Professor Marvin Minsky and nanotechnology founders Drs. Eric Drexler and Ralph Merkel. I could talk to you for probably 10 shows, Professor. Welcome.
Welcome. Good to be here.
We have a little bit of a hum on this phone line, it sounds like. Do you have a light on, perhaps, or something nearby your phone that would be causing it to hum a little?
I can't locate it, Art.
Okay. Well, we can live with it. It's very low level. I don't even know where to start with you. There is so much here. I guess heaven in a chip. There are a lot of things I want to talk to you about, but heaven in a chip. And well, no, let's start here. Would you explain to the audience so that they can understand it? Is it possible? What is fuzzy logic?
Fuzzy logic is reasoning with shades of gray. So, for example, you were talking earlier about the airspace. Just where does the sky end and space begin? not at all clear where does life begin and end. And a non-fuzzy example, something that's artificially black and white, is when you suddenly become an adult at the first second of your 18th birthday. And what you find is the minute you get outside of mathematics or politics, where people, in effect, artificially draw lines, everything's fuzzy. All air is cool and not cool to some degree. Everything is gray to that extent. And what we've tried to do is to endow computers with that same property. A lot of what makes us intelligent is our ability to work with constant uncertainty and imperfect situations and understandings. And we've been packing that bit by bit into computer chips and putting those chips initially into gadgets. And most people listening are using fuzzy logic in their car. A typical car has over 100 computer chips. It's very easy, Art, to program some of those chips to an automatic transmission to help with the process, especially shifting while going downhill, changing gears, or the control of the carburetor, or if you have a camcorder, there's a fuzzy, smart little device in there that's taken a lot of expertise from experts in Japan and packed that into the chip so that it adjusts the autofocus for you, or your microwave oven, or hundreds of other gadgets from washing machines.
Doctor, in a digital sense, everything's a zero or a one.
Correct.
In what way does fuzzy logic... In what way does it function in any different way than that?
Well, you raise the fundamental tension. It does capture the idea of something analog between 0 and 1, and yet the math of fuzzy logic is black and white. And because of that, that was sort of the breakthrough. Once we figured out the math using black and white tools, then we could upload it into chips and build all kinds of systems. Let me just continue for a minute. This ranges not just to every electronics gadget almost that comes out of Japan or Korea, and a few of them from here. The GM Saturn has it in the transmission. The new VW Bug has it in the transmission. They don't advertise in this country the word fuzzy. It's still seen as a pejorative term.
Sure.
But in Germany, for example, this is used in very large-scale signal and systems processing. It's used to control cranes and physical plants. It's used to control sewage. It's even used in the control, God forbid, of nuclear power plants to some degree.
All right, so in other words, instead of a zero or a one, two absolutely defined states, you're talking about sometimes a 0.5, a 0.4, a 0.7, even gradients in between those.
Right.
For example, fuzzy logic.
If we had an air conditioner that had a rule under the form, if the air is cool, then set the motor speed to slow. Well, anytime you take an air measurement, it's cool to some degree. And that's always changing. Every measurement is an exception to some degree of the rule. And so this is smoothly mapping those partially cool measurements into smoothly changing control outputs. Instead of something being all or none, black or white, exactly cool within the range, say, of 65 degrees Fahrenheit to 70 degrees Fahrenheit, it smooths out the rough edges. And by then, combining lots of knowledge like that, it's very easy to represent mathematically and in a computer. And by the way, these computers are digital computers. That's what's neat about this. We use binary logic to capture gray reasoning. We can boost the machine IQ of gadgets. And now, you know, ultimately, we talked about World War, you mentioned World War III, all the way up to smart weapons and so forth.
You know, I read an article from the BBC the other day that stated, it may be a bit premature, but it said the first biological computer was born the other day, and they claimed to be using leeches, you know, the leeches, lousy little leeches, to compute, and they showed this jar full of leeches. It's a disgusting thing to think about, but are they on to something with that direction of development with biological?
They certainly are. That's touching on the sister technology of fuzzy systems, and those are neural networks, are computers that are based on the brain that recognize patterns, and it's often fun to compare them or test them on the simplest neural organisms like worms and leeches and things like that, or to take the giant squid that's been especially popular as a laboratory experimental device to see how signals propagate down fibers. And these systems don't have these creatures don't have a lot of neurons, unlike you and me. In your brain, you have over 100 billion neurons. And by the way, it's easy to remember that number, because that's roughly the number of stars in the Milky Way galaxy, which in turn is roughly the number of known galaxies in the universe.
Interesting coincidence.
Yeah, and I think it's just that. But nevertheless, it's a big number. And by the way, each of those neurons, and I think we want to talk about this later, each of those neurons in your brain emits ones and zeros, in effect, but is connected on average to 10,000 others. And just imagine what's going on in your head right now. You've got 100 billion neurons, emitting almost the random ones and zeros, and sending that to 10,000 other neurons. You're talking quadrillions of signals propagating around there without any central clock, without any kind of government, in effect, running everything. Somehow this wonderful device has figured out how to self-organize.
Professor, what's my clock speed?
That's a good question. And actually, you know, I had mine measured recently. I had a problem with my hand, and there's experiments. And what they do is they shock the heck out of you, poking various nerve fibers, and then measure it, looking at the waveform that pops out. And it's, you know, most people propagate signals at about 40 or 50 meters per second. And that's the classic explanation why, if you're at ground zero at a nuclear burst, you'll never know it, because
that's
the wires
slow.
Will melt before it gets to your brain.
Yeah, that's pretty slow, huh?
Pretty slow.
Actually,
it's,
I mean,
good. It's good enough for biological work. It
yeah, it's nowhere, but it's nowhere near a pentium.
Nowhere near. The pentium would be sleeping constantly, waiting for new signals to come in at that rate.
So, how is it going to be profitable for scientists to be using organic material to compute if the neurons communicate so slowly?
Well, one thing is to boost that neural communication. The other thing is to assist it when it fails. Last year, for the first time, we implanted, I didn't, but scientists collectively, scientists implanted a neural type chip into a blind person, back into the visual cortex. And a bunch of neurons, each one could be on or off, and there's 2 to the n, a very big number of possible states. So this unsighted person suddenly has, kind of see a grid of ones and zeros lighting up in front of them. That's the first step.
I saw that. They actually showed what the blind person saw.
Right, correct.
Absolutely amazing.
Now that's the tough job, though, Art, of grafting chips to flesh and vice versa. And as, of course, the flesh is fixed, and we're figuring it out every day, but the chips, every 18 months, thanks to Moore's Law, are doubling in capacity and basically falling in price. And so a lot of these schemes, mathematically and otherwise, that we've worked out in the last 20 years that were not feasible before, thanks to Moore's Law, either are feasible now or soon will be, and in effect, computer processing is becoming free.
So then, if for no other reason then, that eventually the machines and the humans are going to co-join, you're going to want to begin working with the neurons very quickly.
Right. And I think the way to see that is to refer to the humans as a biomachine and a bioprocessor, and that's what we are. Extremely sophisticated, but we're starting to figure it out. And with that comes a change to many concepts, from legal ones right down to religious ones.
Well, we'll get to those, inevitably. But what a jump from what we're discussing right now to a day, how far away, when you might actually be able to, in effect, and when you talk about digital immortality, I'm assuming that you're contemplating the possibility of downloading the contents of a human brain either into a machine or another human being.
That's right. First off, I would use... the preposition, I'd use uploading. But we would upload from a brain, which is a computer made of 3 pounds of meat, to a different kind of brain, made of a more durable material. Think of it as your brain playing musical tunes right now on a very classical and floppy instrument and shooting that over to a synthesizer, something that can play far more, play the same music, play it in different ways, and it doesn't need sleep or blood sugar.
Right.
So that's the basic idea. But long before that, Art, is what you're starting to see now. And that is the gradual parts replacement, initially with people who need it the most, people who are blind. We have cochlear implants now, and ultimately to help Alzheimer's patients and others. But several of the claims of religion and others to give sight to those who are blinded and to raise the poor, we're achieving now through science.
Doctor, sticking with it for a second, because it fascinates me so, how much storage would you imagine that it would take to contain the contents of a human brain?
Good question. There have been a lot of estimates of that. I give over this in detail in the back of Having That Chip. And by the way, there's like 100 pages of tiny footnotes in the back with mathematics and references to the primary scientific literature.
Right.
But the usual answer is about a billion bits or something to that effect. And the way to think about that is it would take a computer chip today the size of a good large building to replicate the sheer processing power of your brain. We simply can't do it. But every 18 months, you cut that in two. So that by the year, now maybe 2015, 2020, somewhere thereabouts, a computer the size of a sugar cube equals your brain, and forever thereafter greatly outstrips it. Now, that doesn't mean you can just plug it in, of course. That's the tough job of working out the porting technology.
Right.
But it does mean, in effect, a wink of a technological eye, to just it'll be unlimited computation. And that's at hand. That's without going to quantum chips and other things like that.
But, Doctor, the entire contents of a human brain, if that were, and I understand that we're doubling speeds and the amount of storage exponentially increasing
right.
and getting cheaper, and it's incredible what's going on out there. So one could imagine that one day it would be possible. If you transferred the contents of a human brain to a machine and it was stored, would it continue to contain the emotions, the feelings, the memories, the everything of the person that had been uploaded?
The answer is yes, and there's several reasons why, but there's a mathematical one. Of course, I'm not going to prove theorems on the air, but it's a theorem, it's a fact in mathematics, that both neural systems and fuzzy systems are what we call universal approximators. That is, any curve you could draw that wiggles in any imaginable way, in ways that human beings cannot imagine, these systems can, in theory, always approximate if they have enough neurons or rules. So, in principle, your brain is like a surface with trillions of bumps in it. A real complicated mathematical surface. And we can do a real good job of approximating, maybe not getting all the bumps in there at first, but eventually we can. So we know in theory we can do that, and we're creeping up on it. First we do simple surfaces with just a few bumps, but we're getting more bumps all the time as the computer power gets cheaper and cheaper. That's the first question.
Well, now, if you did the... All right.
Here's the real answer, Art. The real answer to your question
yes?
is your knowledge of self, as the classical philosophers and other thinkers have known for years, is an illusion. And we can sustain that illusion of all those signals flowing into you from your skin and from outside of you.
Doctor, we're at the bottom of the hour. Hold on. We'll be right back. Professor Cusco is my guest. I'm Art Bell.
You're listening to Art Bell Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from April 4th, 2001. Somewhere in Time on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from April 4th, 2001.
We're talking with Professor Bart Cusco about his book, Heaven in a Chip. Some of you might say, sounds like hell in a chip. We'll talk about some of that in a moment. I kind of wonder, if I were to be uploaded and wake up and find myself in a machine... Otherwise, I'm the same. I'm Art Bell. I'm every bit the Art Bell I am right now, except I'm in a machine. I am a machine. No, I'm in a machine. If I did this while I was still alive, what would the other Art Bell be doing? And would we be the same individuals from that moment on out, learning, experiencing, feeling, being tortured, loved? How you love a machine. Well, I do know how you love a machine, but it's not really the same. You get some of the questions that I'm about to ask. There may not be answers for them, but we'll try. obviously, I'm going to be pushing Professor Cusco into some science fiction-like areas, although maybe not. Professor, as I just asked on the air, and you said all of this might be possible by the year 20 what?
Well, the question is, how long will it take to have computer chips
right.
that have the sheer processing power of your brain?
Right.
That's somewhere between 2020 and 2030. We used to think it was 2030 or 2050. We're moving that up because of Moore's Law, the doubling of chip density every 18 months.
So then a lot of people now living will live to experience this.
No question about that, but that doesn't mean,
okay.
though, that you could just open the brain and shove it in like the Frankenstein monster.
Well, I know we're going to need a big connector, but...
Correct.
But one would presume that the technologies would proceed along, and probably we would be able to... Let's say we did upload my brain into a machine. Would I be conscious inside that machine in the same sense that I'm conscious right now, theoretically?
And I think the answer is yes, as I said before the break, and the real reason is your notion of self is really a kind of delicately sustained illusion, and we can continue that illusion. But you're touching on something else, though, a little trickier. What if I am living now in a brain and I want to get to the chip? Does the me in the brain die and then wake up in a chip? And how do I know it's the same person in the chip?
That is the question. Now, of course, we can...
I have a fuzzy answer for that, Art.
Well, we can download the information from a disk drive, and all we have is a copy, right?
Right, and the copies pose a whole new problem here of the notion of identity.
All right.
But here's the fuzzy solution. I call it chipping away at your brain. Let's suppose you're wide awake, and the neurosurgeons pop off your skull and cut out a small chunk of your brain, roll it around in some sensors to find out exactly how the chunk works, its input and output, and replace it with an equivalent little golden chiplet.
Yeah.
They put it in, you're wide awake, this doesn't hurt, and when they insert it...
Sounds like it hurts.
It might, but let's assume it doesn't. And they insert the little chiplet, and it feels like you just drank a cup of coffee, but nothing's changed. You're still you. There's still the continuity of self.
Yes.
Even though, of course, you lose that every time you fall asleep. Now we take out another chunk of your brain, another part, and we repeat this process, and we do it step by fuzzy step. And by degrees, you are uploading ultimately to a chip, because in the end, you're in that chip. What's left of your brain is a bunch of chunks floating in solution. And you've made a smooth transition without ever a break in consciousness. This is a classic fuzzy solution to a binary problem, by the way. So that itself is not a problem.
Well, suppose we did it, though, in the manner that I discussed. I would then, at that instant, be in two places. In every sense of me, I would be in two places at one time.
The bifurcation of consciousness. It's a real issue that we'll have to face someday, and we haven't had to date. But even before that time, Art, one of the first things we want to do that'll raise the problem in a different way is to back up. I mean, one of the terrible tricks that nature and evolution has played upon us is that our most precious information has no backup. You get old, the brain withers and dies.
That's right.
The cheapest computer has a backup. And so as you back up, wouldn't you like us to back up your last year or two of brain thought?
I probably wouldn't go for the last year or two. But but there would be segments. Yes, I'd pick out segments, and I'd say, let's have
Wouldn't it be fun just to relive the best moments and the worst moments of your life in very added will?
Oh, yes.
And relive it, Art, not just like watching on a screen, which is sort of a poor man's version of virtual reality, but really relive it with the same vivid sensations that you believe you're experiencing now.
You are there.
Let me tell you what we're really getting at here. We're trying to exorcise a little demon, a little thing called the homunculus, the little man who sits behind the screen in the brain pulling the levers, just like in the movie, by the way, Men in Black, which parodied that idea very well. And here's the way to think about that. If you eat an apple, I ask you, why did you eat that apple? And you say, I wanted to. Fine. Why did you want to? Because my will wanted to. Okay, and here's where it gets difficult. Okay, why did your will want to? There's really no good answer at that point. And this reveals the fiction bearer. There's no little Art sitting inside the brain pulling the levers. It's much more complicated. What there is something like the United Nations or something like a whole bunch of warring, competing neural circuits that are fighting for control. For example, if you look at an image, and in the image is an apple. I say, Art, look at the apple. You can focus your attention somehow that you can't explain on that apple. Now, we can explain that now mathematically. We have tools that show how that selective attention works. There's some neurons in the thalamus that seem to line up and create a false sense of searchlight for the illusion. We can replicate those kinds of things. Let me make this very clear.
Yes, please.
We cannot have it both ways. We cannot enjoy the wonderful advances in science and biology and mathematics and at the same time keep these old concepts, Art, that came around, so far as we know, before there was civilization. Notions of self and the way we speak and the language, these are going to have to give way to different concepts.
How do you really know that that will end up being true?
How do
you really know that if you download bit by bit or collectively my entire brain, that you'll really have the emotional me, the real me, all of me?
Well, again, I can work out the math of why glass breaks when I shatter, but technically I have to break the glass each time to test that hypothesis. We don't know until you actually do it, of course, but you can make some very good reasoned guesses. But I want to stress, the neural systems we work with, the fuzzy systems we work with, both obey the wonderful property of universal approximation. They, in theory, could do anything. That's presumably why nature stumbled upon these devices and is developing ways we're still trying to figure out. We work with the simplest. Just four or five neurons can often recognize very complex arrays of patterns. And again, you have over 100 billion working in your brain that have been tuned for millions of years through your ancestors. So we have a much better sense that with that kind of computational power, the distributed parallel neural power that everybody has in their brain, and not just in the brain, just what you have in your big toe is pretty impressive, and your spine is very impressive, that you're able to approximate a lot of things. By the way, a lot of things that we can't right now imagine, the true capabilities of the human mind, if you look at it mathematically, are beyond comprehension.
It brings up another really interesting possibility. If I can be uploaded to a machine or even another human brain, then why would it not be possible to virtually record or upload the experiences of another person? Let's say somebody who does the idiotic, crazy, insane echo challenge. I don't know if you've seen any of that stuff. These people torture themselves to death. And have me experience every minute of that echo challenge.
Aren't you touched on something a lot of us expect, that someday, we won't live to see it, unfortunately. Those of us in the tank might come out and witness it. But someday this will be a form of entertainment. It's exactly that. But it's more than that.
Oh, it's much more than that. It's so much more than that, that why shouldn't we be afraid, scared to death of that? Because that kind of available reality, I mean, they talk about reality TV. This would be actually being there, doing it, feeling every cut, every bruise, every bit of pain, everything that person experienced. That would be so overwhelming and so encompassing that it would be tempting to forego life for one extreme experience after another.
Well, again, if you jump there first, but in the same way, can you imagine Art 100 years ago telling someone we're going to have 200 people flying through the sky in metal boats? I mean, they'd say, are you kidding? I'd be terrified to do that, and we couldn't imagine society now without it. But if you get there degrees, I think you'll find it'll be a popular form of entertainment. But there's something else going on here, too, and it has.
Well, we've got a problem now, Doctor, with people watching 5 hours of television a day. If you offered them this, you would be offering them something that would be better than life.
Well, I think in the end, Art, that life is going to turn out to be grist for our imaginative mill. We take the sensations of us and others in the past and random number generators to create more. But if we look at the real set of mathematical possibilities that even our humble brains could experience, we haven't sampled a fraction of a fraction of a fraction percent of it. There's a lot of sensations and patterns out there to think about and do that we haven't imagined. But no doubt, entire sense modalities. In fact, if you just took the human genome and looked at the mathematical possibilities of what we know of the genome now, about 30,000 genes, and the way it's built up out of amino acids, you could construct creatures consistent with that, that what you would think are bug-eyed monsters from outer space, but still compatible with the human genome. There's so much potential combinatorially when you're playing with this many elements.
If you create something of that sort, why would it not imagine us as simply a bunch of pests, intellectual dullards that would be better, I don't know, serving them in their needs, whether it be electricity or whatever it might be.
This is a classic concern. If we have the big mega supercomputer chewing away and we're nothing like a dog with some speeded up thoughts that doesn't have anything really intelligent to say to them, I guess
precisely.
That's possible.
Well, according
but
to what you're saying, it is.
I think that you will be that power. You will have that expansion of thought. And get there a step at a time, a chip at a time. But you did touch on something else, though, the idea that we are watching more TV. And we are. What is that really? That's just signal processing. We love to bombard our sense receptors, our skin and our eyes and other things, with as much and as rich a stimuli as we can get. I think that trend is going to continue in ways that we really can't anticipate. This is truly the tip of the iceberg. I think it'll be a lot of fun.
Well, one can imagine living all kinds of scenarios, underground tapes going around or chips or whatever they would be. I mean, I'm sure you can imagine all the permutations that would be possible, right?
It's a small subset of them, but yeah.
Yes. So how does that not, in effect, destroy society as we have always known it and loved it and hated it, or... Would you say it will do that, and it'll be a better place?
Again, the word destroy is pretty strong, Art. I think if you were to take a snapshot of 100 years from now, I think we would all say, my God, people want to live in that. And that's probably been true for the last 100 years, the last 500 years, or any given 100-year snapshot. But it's going to be much more intense in the next, given these rapid rates of change. But getting there by degrees, I think we'll not only get there, I think people will be standing in line to get there. I think it would be such a rich experience. Just the idea of conquering death and disease itself should be enough. It may make us all into couch potatoes of the worst kind. I mean, one of the classic problems in philosophy is called the brain in a vat problem. How can you prove that you right now aren't a brain sitting in a vat of fluid somewhere? Very much like brought out in the movie Matrix. And technically you can't.
Technically I can't. You're right.
You get real close and you have some reasonable guesses. And then you realize, again, looking at this as an illusion of self, a sense of ability to focus your concentration and struggling to recapture those items of memory, and again, of course, this gets worse with age. We can do that, and we can do so much better.
Well, in the legal world, though, you use the benchmark is what a reasonable person would conclude.
Correct.
And as a reasonable person, I conclude I'm not in a vat at the moment, floating about, thinking my thoughts. However, I can imagine myself in a vat, and I can imagine your technology eventually getting me there, or perhaps my son or his son, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Your chip son.
But I mean, what kind? My chip son. Oh, but what kind of world is that going to be? Is that really going to be a world that you, for example? Well, you know what? You would probably want to live in that world because, reading down a little further, you wear a bracelet.
Correct.
What is this bracelet for?
This is to freeze me when I die.
Freeze
I
you.
Deanimate. And there's a reason for that. We don't have backup. And unfortunately, most of us alive today simply were born a little too early. We're not going to live to the good times when it's relatively cheap and expensive to upload, at least for those in developed countries at first. There's only one way, with any chance of scientific plausibility whatsoever, however slight that may be, of backing yourself up. It's not a good way. It's not a cheap way. But it is the only way. And that is upon your death or deanimation, recognizing that you are your synapses, you are your brain. That's the hardware, but it's been conditioned like software through your experiences to freeze that. Now, it's not going to spontaneously come back when you thaw it out. In fact, it looked like if you ever seen a frozen strawberry when you thaw that out. But with the proposed nanotechnology of the future, with molecular engineering, with a bit of patience, you, in theory, without violating laws of physics, without any great cost, can reconstruct it a cell at a time and boost it. And that's a good way, I say the only way at the present, to back up. So the real question is, would you bet your life on this? No. But I am more than happy to bet my death on it.
Professor, are you going to have your entire body frozen or just your...
I happen to be one of those, Art. I'm an all-body kind of guy.
I know there's a choice, either the
head
or the body.
And the neural suspension of the head is much better, and I recommend it to the interested listener. For a relatively small sum, Art, each month, you can set that money aside that you would otherwise spend on the movies, and it goes to an insurance policy that upon your death pays Alcor, the Cryonics outfit, to suspend you. It's not a big deal. The liquid nitrogen is cheap, and you do time in a bottle at minus 320 degrees Fahrenheit, where there's no change. If you have to wait 50 years or 500, it really makes no difference.
Are they in California?
They move from California.
Oh, good. See, all those rolling blackouts.
Exactly. Rolling black and earthquakes are a big issue. That's why if you're all body, they put you upside down so the head would thaw last. They've moved to Scottsdale, Arizona.
Uh-huh. Oh, good move. So your entire body is going to be preserved cryogenically.
Right. First, you're pumped through of antifreeze, of glycerin. And then
antifreeze?
Antifreeze, basically. Glycerin. It takes about 10 days to cool you down to that level, and then you're you're frozen. The other alternative is bury or burn, which have zero chance in terms of the information lost of reconstruction. I mean, the real tragedy, Art, is that we all, in effect, have one car from the lot, and it's starting to fall apart. Now, this idea here, that we'd like to keep upgrading it, or in theory, repairing the same car over and over. But nature didn't dealt us that hand.
Or even get a brand new car, ultimately.
Absolutely.
Aye, 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 doctor. I guess I ought to ask, you don't have to answer, about your religious beliefs, because a lot of people of religion, of course, would never consider freezing themselves.
But why is that, Art? They go to sleep
well,
at night?
Well, because in their opinion, when they die, they have something called a soul, which goes then through a natural transition to possibly another dimension, to somewhere else where consciousness continues, to which,
but, Art,
which you say what?
When they go to sleep, where does that soul go?
I've always wondered about that myself.
Another thing, many surgeries now are such that the body is emptied of blood and liquid, watery, icy water is pumped through the veins.
I saw the 60 Minutes
piece. Exactly. That's a good example. And you're, according to the old definitions, you're dead, but of course we can bring that back to life. Where'd the soul go in that case?
Where'd the soul go?
The era of the soul arguments go back to our ancient natural language. And a good way to, I think, put this notion in perspective is someone's looking at your watch, looking at a time handle, suddenly it stops, and I say, oh, where'd the motion go? No, it's just a matter of energy and gears. And in fact, there are very religious people in cryonic suspension now and are signed up for it. I mean, it's in theory compatible with it, but you're right, on its face, it does seem to fly in the face of these earlier supernatural notions
out
about
of curiosity,
the ghost and machine.
Out of curiosity, Professor, when these people agree to be frozen as a... very religious people, Christians, whatever.
Yeah.
Where did they think their soul would be while they were cryogenically frozen? And when they are retrieved, if that ever becomes possible, where do they think their soul will be then?
It's a good question. I've never heard a good answer from them.
Oh. Well, then...
These are faith issues.
Yes. Those people of great faith who are frozen right now, aren't they sort of hypocritical in a way?
I'm not convinced of that. I mean, if we think about those sci-fi movies we used to like from the 60s and 70s, be it Planet of the Apes, when Charlton Heston wakes up from a form of cryonic suspension, or those unlucky scientists frozen and killed by HAL the computer in 2001, now, there didn't seem any major problems about their soul. It was a form of sleep, and so was this. We simply stopped the motion. Here's another way to think about it. We have different scales of time, of course, and right now you and I are thinking in very slow neural time. You mentioned this before the break. If you're on a chip time, 30 seconds of hour slow neural time can be many, many hundreds or even thousands of years. So time's an issue. But if you're on quantum time, we're talking issues at 10 to minus 43. In a quantum episode, where'd your soul go? Now, you and I are suspended robots during that period of time. I don't think the old supernatural notion of soul has been sufficiently well worked out to handle that, nor can it address the problem of how can something that has no senses enjoy the claimed senses of heaven, like eating grapes. We can deal with all those problems in the digital domain.
You could even convince a machine that, here, have a grape. Enjoy it.
Again, I'd stress, Art, that if aliens came now and looked at us, they would say, what are these two machines talking about to each other? They are machines. Ultimately, they're energy and gears.
That's very interesting. We've got a break here at the top of the hour, Doctor. Hold on. Remember, I think it was Dr. Kaku I asked, wouldn't they... No, it was... I know who it was. It was Seth Shostak of SETI, and I said, Dr. Shostak, isn't it likely that the first beings we will encounter, the first extraterrestrials, are going to be machines? Asked him for the first time ever that question last time he was on, and he said, absolutely. The odds are very high indeed. They will be machines.
In the year 2525, if man is still alive, if woman can survive, they may find. In the year 3535, gonna need to tell the truth.
and say is in the pill you took today. In the year 45, he's gonna eat your teeth, won't eat your eyes. You won't find a thing to chew. Nobody's gonna look at you.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from April 4th, 2001.
A prophetic song, I imagine so. We'll ask in a moment. My guest is Professor Bart Kosko. All kinds of education, all kinds of experience in the areas that we're talking about, fuzzy logic, what's coming, very well credentialed, and he'll be right back. Once again, Professor Bart Kosko, Professor, does that song sound perhaps a little prophetic to you?
Yes, it does, Art, and bless you for playing it. I have to tell you this. When I was a young boy on a farm in Kansas, I and my friends would sit around listening to that, smoking pot, talking about the future, and that had a lot to do with my choice of career in science, that very song by Zager and Evans in the year 2525 is extremely thoughtful.
Well, wait a minute, Professor. Smoking pot, why? How come you don't have too many brain cells fried and cooked to be transferred anywhere or even to function well enough to get to earn a doctorate and all the rest of that? I mean,
I don't know. It worked wonders for me. I don't smoke it anymore and haven't for quite a while, but it helped open doors. I read the books by Aldous Huxley and others and experimented with those kinds of things in the early 70s.
So I take it you're not in favor of the government's war on plants.
No, and more than that, Art, I think, just on this point, that people who have, in the educational elite, have an undue power over other folks by way of the government, and in particular the medical establishment. If you, as an adult, wish to walk into a store and buy penicillin at your own risk, willing to forego suing someone if you assume the risk, and by all means should be able to do that. So not only should the nonsense of the war on so-called drugs be eliminated, there's no basis in the Constitution for it. At least in the old days of prohibiting alcohol, they had to amend the Constitution. This one didn't go that way. But I think it's inevitable that this will go all the way to self-medication.
This obviously would have application for, let's say, when all of this first becomes available and we first start doing all of this. People of wealth, people with money, and it's going to take, it always, no matter what the technology is, it always costs a lot at the beginning, right?
Absolutely.
So the people who are going to be able to afford this sort of thing are going to be the very well off. How would you imagine them doing it? In other words, somehow we picture an old guy on his deathbed, the last throes, and you're going to upload his brain. Well, what you're going to get is what there is, and that's
right.
Kind of a degraded brain at that point, isn't it?
It raises a real question about when is it an optimal time to die or upload. But the nature on this score of cryonics is what we call computer science a push-down stack. Remember those trays, you put one on top and it pushes down the whole stack?
Yes.
Well, the property there is that, and really in dire straits, it raises the question when you should be frozen. And one of my colleagues, Dr. Thomas Donaldson, had this very trauma because he had brain cancer.
I know the case.
You know the case.
I know the case very well. It made national headlines.
Right, and even it inspired an episode of L.A. Law that turned out far more favorably than it worked out in real L.A. Law. But his case, he's a mathematician, was he said, look, I don't want to wait till I'm dead and possibly autopsy, which would destroy the whole thing. I want to be frozen now. And the government wouldn't allow that. And fortunately for him, his tumor was, and I understand still is, in remission, but could come back at any point.
You know him personally?
Professionally through our...
Professionally, all right. If you were faced with his situation, would you make the fight to be frozen early?
You bet.
You would?
Absolutely. Like a shot. You are your synapses.
Do you honestly have that much faith in the cryogenic technology?
It's cryotic technology, by the way. Not so much that I have it in that. That's just a suspension mechanism. I have faith in science. Now, again, whether it's 50 years or 500, even 5,000, it makes no difference. At minus 320 degrees Fahrenheit,
yes,
there is no change. Quantum changes barely occur. Time is frozen. This is forward-only time travel.
But there is a problem, though. I mean, if you keel over with a heart attack in a parking lot somewhere, and it takes them quite a while to get to you,
yeah,
and then transport you to the appointed freezing location, your brain is beginning to turn to mush already.
We call that molecular death.
Yes,
even
indeed.
Worse if you're in a fire or something.
Well, a fire would be very bad.
We all run that risk.
But if you choose the moment yourself, when you are still of sound mind, legal term, I guess, then presumably you would be revived or uploaded in that precise state or close to it when you're thawed.
With one problem with the government, and which I want to point out has been supported and aided and abetted here by the undertaker and funeral industry, a dark little industry that seldom gets explored. But the problem is right now, if you do that, if you basically killed yourself to be frozen,
yes,
you almost guarantee an autopsy to destroy your brain.
Courtesy of the government.
Absolutely.
So
there's another problem with this. If you want to leave some money, for example, to compound, just put it in a bond. Like Benjamin Franklin put a dollar in the bank knowing that in 150 years or so it would amount a huge quantity because of the exponential returns.
Sure.
We don't have that kind of in perpetuity status in this country. The money goes by default to the government after 20 or so years. I believe Liechtenstein and two other countries have that. That's another issue, because part of this is ultimately funded by a pot of money and what are called resurrection bounties to give people incentive to pull you out.
Well, I was going to say you could do all this under the table, I suppose, but you really couldn't do these legal things under the table.
Right.
You'd want some sort
of status.
We're going
to have to readdress all that. Just as now with cloning other things, we have to rethink the nature of conception and offspring. This will happen on the other end of death and resurrection. For example, what if you're a mass murderer and you want to be chronically suspended? Will they allow that? I don't know.
No, I wouldn't. But who am I? What about, you mentioned cloning. Now, the Raelians, I've interviewed the Raelians. You know who they are, right?
You're going to have to refresh me on that.
Oh, you don't? All right. The Raelians probably are going to be the first.
Oh, yes. I'm sorry. I do know. Yes.
They're going to be the first to clone a little 10-year-old girl.
Correct.
They actually believe that it's going to be possible and soon to clone and then use the process you're talking about to replace the brain of the clone with the present brain of the needy person. We'll put it that way.
I think they've got some pretty good odds on the first act and very bad odds on the second. And I would point out, though, what they're really talking about is just another form of reproduction. You know, people have all kinds of silly ideas about sex as it is. This is really no different than that. And I think the argument for having children to give children to infertile couples, you know, is a compelling one. And you'll see that being the entering edge of the wedge here.
Definitely not going to be as much fun. Well, I mean, that is saying something. But I suppose you would separate sex and reproduction totally.
Or if I say one other thing about cloning, because the media, I think, gets this wrong all the time. If you like navel oranges, you're eating clones. Almost every fruit tree in America and most around the world is a cloned tree.
That's true.
We graft things on.
True.
And we've been doing this for a long time. All of our food is genetically modified. The chromosomes of an ear of corn are really a Frankenstein nightmare if you think about it. But this has been going on for a very long time. It's quite natural to extend it from the animal kingdom to the...
Have you been hearing, just incidentally, the story yesterday that several of the cloned animals are beginning to die, and they're dying from diseases of the immune system? You been hearing about that?
I've heard that in other issues, because it raises a very real question. One issue has to do, each time the cell divides, there's a little tape in there called the telomerase tape.
Yes.
And you snip it off, and when it snips off about 50 times or so, that's it. You run out and you die. And the question is, like with Dolly, as I understand it, does Dolly get a brand new telomerase tape when she's born, when it was born, or is it the tape of the mother that was fairly old? And as I understand, the telomerase tape was still in good condition. Of course, it doesn't mean you could overcome these other problems. And there are real issues about creating a creature so quickly in a dish when you might otherwise have 9 months in gestation. You know, evolution's had a long time to work out the bugs in that approach.
Mm.
I would think at first you'd have some problems.
How do you feel ethically and morally about pursuing this whole... You obviously, I mean, you're very confident the way you speak. You're very confident. You're very sure. You've taken personal steps. So I suppose it's a silly question, but do you have any moral or ethical reservations about this technology proceeding?
Which technology?
Well, everything we've been discussing, from cloning to eventually down or uploading a human brain, and or those things that will obviously be in between, many of which arguably will advance and help mankind in many ways. But, I mean, as you look down the road in this technology, there are going to be some pretty big moral, ethical questions.
There will, and there will be unforeseen dangers. I don't foresee any major ones at the time, but you never do in advance. But the answer is no. And I think, again, 100 years ago, when life expectancy, you and I in almost all likelihood would be dead by now, people would be scared. Are we fiddling with the natural way of things, living to age 70 and 80 on average?
Yes.
And I don't think so at all. I don't mind using a toothbrush or driving in a car or an airplane. I think it's all within the realm of scientific possibility. The real issue in something like this, Art, is to what extent will the law evolve? And the law is somewhat like your brain. It's an adaptive system, and it's done a pretty good job of adapting. A case in point has to do with spam email. Spam email has been a problem, of course, for most people. And the courts have been pretty good. They took the old medieval doctrine of trespass to chattels, chattel being movable property, and said when someone sends you spam, that in effect is a form of virtual trespass. So
it
rather
is.
Than create
it
new
is.
Laws, they've updated it. It's a case called from 1997 called CompuServe versus Cyber Promotions. You can look it up online. And it's set a precedent into the process of stare decisis that will evolve. I think that will happen here, too. A step at a time. The crucial thing is that those who take the risk, though, are going to have to indemnify and bear the potential cost.
If here's a good one then for you. If the there was a process available by which you could upload your brain to some sort of machine until something else was figured out, and you had a brain tumor, we'll make it easy for you here, would you be prepared to do that today, if you had to?
You used the word reasonable before, and if there were a reasonable expectation that it would work, and if the alternative was a good old be burned or buried, then sure. Again, these technologies have one great thing in their favor, that the alternatives are hopeless.
Now, let's get science fiction-y, I guess, for a moment. Maybe you can project this. Once the brain was in the machine, would it continue to expand, learn, feel,
yes.
Have emotions.
Well, let's take that one at a time. What is learning? Learning is change of your synapses.
Yes.
These are the wires. If you took a brain and cut it open, you see a lot of gray matter. That's basically wires. The neurons are largely on the outside, that convoluted surface of the neocortex.
Right.
And every time a photon hits your eye, it makes a little change.
Right.
Brains are remarkably plastic. That's, by the way, a reason to be careful what you watch on TV or who you hang out with. It leaves its mark, maybe subconsciously, but it's modifying those synapses. Now, if we model synapses, as we do mathematically, and you can download free neural software to demonstrate this, and in fact, I introduced something called the BAM, or the bidirectional associative memory, that's available in the public domain. You can test this. You'll see that we can create, with very simple now, electrical devices or in software, little learnable synapses. Now, if we've uploaded you into a device that has those, it has not just your current number of quadrillions, perhaps many more, or those that modify and change with far more sophisticated learning algorithms, and I assure you, Art, there are hundreds. And there are three journals that describe this, the Journal of Neural Networks, which I'm one of the editors, associate editors, the Journal of Neural Computation, and the IEEE Transactions on Neural Networks. They come out monthly, and each month they're chock full of algorithms that if you could capture in the way you're talking about, would give you what we view as superhuman capabilities. So yes, you'll continue to learn. All these patterns and experiences, that whole illusion of self that we call self.
How would I find my satisfaction, my emotion? Would I turn from the physical, ultimately, as I was in the machine, to the pure intellectual, finding my happiness, my joy, my satisfaction in the completion of some problem that was put to me? In other words, how would I how would I?
I think you're envisioning a world of sterile Mr. Spocks walking around. My answer to that is, think about, you and I are living in computers right now. Again, they're just sloppy computers made of 3 pounds of meat. They have this bizarre property of needing sleep. A bump on the head screws them up.
Yes.
A lot of what you take to be your emotions and changes are simply fluctuations in blood sugar. And other things, of course, strokes can happen, all sorts of strange deteriorations. So I don't think that's fundamentally different. I like to think of it, again, as the patterns of the mind, like music. And you can, if you want to replay the patterns or the kinds of patterns you have now, you should be able to do that with no problem. But you can do vastly more original and more powerful things, beginning with the ability to edit memories at will. First off, having a complete vivid memory. Let me tell you another bad property about neurons that we have, all mammals have. Neurons work on a 40-millisecond window. They add up the little pulses flowing in, and that's basically it. And then if enough of them come in, they'll change a synapse. But do you really want a 40-millisecond window? That's why we forget everything so quickly. You read a book at night, and you've forgotten 95% the next day. This is what we call the recency effect, and it's really easy to see mathematically why it happens. It has to do with what's called a decay term. And we know how to deal with that. But you would like, I think, to be able to vary at will. I mean, for example, what we were talking about 20 minutes ago is kind of faded from memory. It's on your tape.
So in other words, I might find joy in, even heavenly joy, in being able to remember everything.
Right, or not to remember it. I mean, if you really shake, as a lot of folks do, that your childhood traumas are interfering with your life, then you'll be able to control and filter those out and do many other things. And maybe, you know, in effect, have memories that, from experiences that you didn't directly have. But this is, all should be things under your control. They're not now. You're under control of it.
Professor, do you ever see Young Frankenstein?
Sure.
You remember the Abby Normal brain?
Absolutely.
When you said we might make mistakes along the way, if you were to take an Abby Normal brain and upload it to a machine, would you still have an Abby Normal brain, or would you then have something that you could sectionalize and use perfectly well?
Well, the first point is, I think that we have 2 points. The first point is, I think that the very abnormal nature, maybe disease or big brain tumor there or something, we like to think caused some of the aberrant behavior. So we should be able to avoid that, but the first order would be the same behavior. But the second point, I'm glad you brought up Frankenstein, because I always ask myself as a kid, Art, whatever happens if they put the good brain in? You never see that in a movie.
No, you never see that.
And that's really what we're talking about.
We all know that the jars get mixed up. We've seen it. I'm kidding you.
You dropped the brain in a slot, I believe.
Yeah, that's right. Yes, I mean, you're right. So, a good brain.
I think, by the way, most crimes view Dr. Frankenstein as a hero.
I'm just trying to understand how I would feel in a machine. Would I find my satisfactions in all of this memory, in this ability to compute endlessly, to grow and learn endlessly? Would these be my mental orgasms?
Could be, but again, the easy answer is, we're in a machine now, we seem to have fun with that. But I explored this in the novel Nanotime that you mentioned, that once you go through a kind of Buddhist, like the Buddha did, at first he was into sensory experiences and all the wine, women, and songs he could handle, and after that,
right,
you really might want to have fun in an interesting spiritual way, contemplating things that we can't now, listening to music that doesn't have two or three independent voices, but 200 or 300 or 1,000, really having something interesting to think about in terms of origins of the universe, and more complex ideas that just wouldn't fit in our little brains right now. So I think there would be all sorts of things on the conceptual frontier.
I think I mentioned to you that Seth Shostak from SETI said the most likely encounter we human beings will have, if we have one, if we are contacted, the most likely scenario is we will be contacted by machines.
Correct. And there's a real simple reason why. Information is the cheapest thing to transmit. Matter is very expensive. And so we'll likely find some information beam, or something that encapsulates that and can create that, the robot probe. We're already doing that ourselves on other planets, but if someone has a million-year start on us, you would think that they'd be doing that to a great extent.
Would it be the eventual societal evolution of any planet that manages to survive to essentially become machines, from biological to move to the machine?
You know, I think that's right. If you go back and read the book 2001, not the movie, but the book, they try to...
Oh, wasn't that a great book?
It's a wonderful book.
Hold on. We'll pick up on that when we get back. We're at break time here. I'm Art Bell. This is Coast to Coast AM.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from April 4th, 2001.
but she lets me down every time. Can't make her mine. She's no one's lover tonight. With me, she'll be so inviting. I want her all for myself. Oh, dear, I'm patient. Looking through my mind. Oh, dear,
presents Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight's program originally aired April 4th, 2001.
You know, there may be some rides that you may not want to take, or you may want to think about for a while. Not Professor Cusco. He's already decided. He's going to be taking that trip. I'm Art Bell. We'll be right back. Professor, I believe you said something about 2001.
Correct. You ask what's next in the biggest picture. If you think about the end of the book, 2001, not the movie, Stanley Kubrick tried to capture this with that wonderful display, psychedelic display of colors at the end. But if you read the book, you see Arthur Clarke was talking about becoming information, becoming your own thought, really capturing the idea of the great German philosopher Arthur Schopenhauer, who said, the world is my idea of it, and ultimately mingling with space and time itself. And to weave yourself into the very fabric of the universe. And there's a lot of reasons for that. There's a relationship, as we know, between matter and energy. We're also discovering relationships between energy and information.
I rather fancied at the end of the book that he, in essence, became a god. I guess that'd be another way to put it.
In terms of how we would define
yes.
God, I think that's absolutely right.
Yes.
But I think Arthur tried to take that a little further. And the idea that more advanced species will have shed these mortal coils and the constraints that what Arthur has called the tyranny of matter, Sir Arthur, I should say now, the tyranny of matter. And again, if there's a relationship between mass and energy equals mc squared, and a relationship between energy and information, it follows that there's a relationship between information and matter. And here it is. It's something given to us by what's called the Hawking-Bekenstein equation. You can measure the information content of anything, of you, of a book, by throwing it into a black hole and seeing how big the black hole's belly swells. And so the question arises, can we view the entire world as made of information? And some thoughtful physicists answer that by saying if we threw the whole universe into a black hole, we would get amount of information that's 10 to the number 120, which roughly is the number of all possible chess games, by the way. And that's what we are worth in this universe, where the bit count is bigger than a Google, which is 10 to the 100, it's 10 to the 120. There is a deep connection between information and matter. And we're exploring it. So one concept that a lot of folks have looked at is what about the idea of the universe as a kind of chip? And now we're turning that around here, seeing the chip can be a kind of universe. And that's ultimately behind the idea.
All right, let me try a couple of questions. Mike in Las Vegas wants to know, if a large number of people are ported into computers, who's going to pay to keep the electricity on for them? Will they be imprisoned in computers as slaves, working for juice forever imprisoned?
That was the theme of the movie Matrix,
uh-huh.
Which did broach the question, though. How can you be sure you're...
Well, it's not such a crazy question.
It's a good question. And it brings up the real problem with uploading to a chip. That is, somebody with a flip of a switch can end your eternity just that quickly.
Yes.
But the energy costs, as chips get smaller and more efficient, are smaller and smaller themselves. If we play this out, How could we be in a chip and have indefinite time spans? Well, first point, time in a chip is thousands, millions of times, maybe billions of times faster than what we call neural time, the slow time. Your sense of time is very subjective. Again, 1 minute of our time right now can easily be 100 years plus on chip time, even with nanoprocessors that are under design. So you can get a lot of that. Ultimately, you could always get energy sucked out of a star or black hole somewhere, but it does raise the more serious questions with our system of government evolved out of tribal warfare and such, that one of the real problems with anything like this, of not just a full upload, but even a partial implant, is the control of the government. Do you want the Supreme Court finding a, quote, compelling governmental interest and having access to your chip? What about evil thoughts? Or, you know, they'll give new meaning to the notion of a hate crime if they can simply get a subpoena and downplay your, replay your thoughts.
Yeah, but information ultimately is power, and you know our government will be first in line doing all this because the super mind can sure create the super weapon, can't it?
It can do that, and but this really raises a deeper question, Art. If we start all going to our own little heaven in a chip, each man or woman or thing, a king unto his own castle or bubble, we don't really need governments anymore. I mean, this is something a government...
Oh, see, now that will really bother them, I guarantee you.
Well, but in the end, economics wins out. And governments, if you think about it, are powers, are monopolies on power in a region. They're atom-based kinds of things. You know, the logic of the sword, you know, we see that now with the battle over China, who owns the kind of fuzzy airspace or other spaces.
The fuzzy airspace.
Well, we don't, the property rights are not well-defined. Just like if I blow smoke in your face, you know, I don't have good control, 100% control of that smoke, and it's a fuzzy. Wherever you have fuzzy property rights, you typically have a legal problem.
Mm.
But as time passes, it's just not clear what the function of a government would be. Now, you may want to govern yourself in a chip. And in fact, if you think about a lot of the classical religions, especially the Middle Eastern religions, kind of view heaven and God as like big government in the sky, and God is a kind of alien dictator or something. And people may choose to do that.
You know, even our government, which is the best of the worst,
it
look at what it's doing with the drug war. Why is it waging the drug war? Mainly, I believe, because it hurts productivity. Because when we are feeling really good or stoned or whatever, we're not productive. And if we're not productive, we're not paying many taxes and we're not supporting the government. Now, what you have envisioned in terms of, for example, uploading a human brain, or no, let's back off from that. Let's just say being able to experience what somebody else has experienced.
Yes. Swapping
memory.
Oh,
my God. Now we can live entirely vicariously. We can do it 24 hours a day if we want to, we still have to sleep. So we could do it most of our waking hours. We could live a wonderful, vicarious life. You know damn well it's going to be a war against chips.
Could be. I think at first there will be that. There'll be the have chips and not have chips kind of arguments. But I think the drug war is a different matter. I think that's like slavery was. People know that the arguments aren't there. They know that a black market in any substance kicks up the price. We have the evidence of alcohol prohibition. They know that's wrong.
It would be more psychologically addicting than any drug we've got today.
But when the ship is going in a certain direction, like the ship of state has been on this, and it hit a fever frenzy in the 70s and 80s on this, I think it takes a while to turn around, and just as it did with alcohol prohibition and with slavery. People knew that was wrong long before, but still, you read the Constitution, there's a slavery clause in there. It's been struck out by the 13th Amendment, but what was that doing in there in 1790? And I think the same thing here, when a certain generation, an older generation, frankly, dies off, I think you'll see the drug war is just a bad memory of the past.
But you're not dying off. You're going to freeze yourself.
I am going to, right. I'm talking about the current power structure.
Yeah,
and I want to stress also for the listener, Art, how easy it is to do this and how only 1,000 people have done this. This is not a big deal financially. If you amortize it out, paying a little bit each month for an insurance contract, how big a deal is that as a kind of backup?
Now, let's try a little. Let me ask you a question about this, all right? Let us say in the next 30 or 40 years, you're close to death and you're frozen. You manage to get by the barriers and you're frozen pretty instantly, and you've got good prospects of being revived.
Mm-hmm.
As you look technologically into the future, when do you think, Professor, that you will likely wake up?
I think our usual window where we can't predict beyond is 50 years. And if we ask what kind of technology would you need to bring someone up? Today, You know, it'd be like trying, as the critics have often said, trying to resurrect a cow from the hamburger. We couldn't do that at all. But if you view the body as a container of information, the DNA is very clear evidence of that, but there's much more beyond it. Like, for example, what's encoded at the synapse at a higher level. If you view that as information, all that is maintained when you're in the tank. Sure, there's incredible ice damage now, despite the efforts to minimize it with glycerin and other antifreeze.
Well, we're not that far from the cow from the hamburger.
Okay, but let me make this point. But if you view that as information, then what do we really need to restructure? You need little devices doing manufacturing and construction at the cell level, at the nano level, not at the molecular, microprocessor level. Right now we're working with big blobs of molecules. You know, so in theory, for example, you could take an orange and unstack the orange molecules and restack them as apple molecules, and you've just turned an orange into an apple. It would look like black magic today. I suspect it will be commonplace to some future generations. So we know that's okay, and it's doable. It requires a level of molecular engineering. There's several trillion cells in the body, and it's a big problem, but it's an engineering problem. It's not a religious problem. It's not a government problem. It's something, in theory, we can knock out, and with the increasing efficiencies of science and markets, we'll, in all likelihood, do that. So,
may I ask you a personal question? Are you married?
Yes, I am.
Children?
Yes, I have one, yeah.
Uh-huh. How about the prospect of you, because after all, you are thinking about you, being revived at a time when your wife will be long gone, your son will be long gone, maybe
daughter.
Your grandchildren, or daughter, I'm sorry, will be long gone. You may have grandchildren or great-grandchildren or even greater, who knows, but everybody you know, everything you knew, it's all gone.
I think we call this the tears of the Buddha. It'll be so sad that all my friends and non-friends and strangers I would like to have met simply didn't take that simple precautionary step. They were grasshoppers, not ants, and they weren't backup. That'll be sad, but I suspect, Art, there'll be so many distractions and entertainments of the day, and my question is, will my PhD still be good? I don't know. I'll be happy to get another one. But I think, you know, it'll be a lot of fun. Just imagine, again, if it were 1,000 or 100 years ago, or 1,000 years ago, if you were a Viking somehow frozen and revived now, you'd miss the old days to be sure, but I think you'd fit right in and you'd be watching Survivor after a week.
So in other words,
we're adaptable.
Now we sit at a computer. Oops, there is the blue screen of death. Oh, we try to reboot. Oh, it won't boot. Oh, it says there's not even a hard drive there. You put your head in your hands. That's death. All right? And you're imagining that before that moment, we simply copied the hard drive, and so we...
The software.
Ideally. The software, yes.
We're freezing the hard drive that has a software...
equating the hard drive to the brain.
Okay.
And so there you are. You imagine that every bit of you, again, all the emotions, all the feelings, all the memories, all the everything, it would all be there. The only thing is that the people who are running this, this machine...
If they're people, yeah.
Well, if they're people... could begin to administer all kinds of changes, cause you to forget your wife and your children, and in fact your life. And in fact, they could actually, couldn't they, Professor, virtually erase everything that was your identity,
using you
as a machine for their own purposes, whatever those might
be.
That
could certainly happen. They could implant, you know, politically correct chips to filter out bad thoughts of the day. Especially, might be very afraid of someone coming back who's born in the 20th century in the future. That's certainly possible. Or they might view you as a kind of precious time relic to be cherished. But I just don't think it'll be a big deal. I think, in the end, there'll come a point when disease is conquered first. That's inevitable. And death becomes something largely voluntary. People's lifespans will go up to a few hundred years when cells, in effect, regenerate. And there's a lot of schemes how that might happen. And there'll be a small number of people still floating in a tank, and maybe just for sentimental reasons, they'll bring them out and resurrect them.
Do you remember the Star Trek episode where all the little brains in the petri dishes or whatever they were sitting around betting on gladiators?
It's ringing a distant bell.
A distant bell. Well, anyway,
there's another Star Trek episode that does come to mind. And at the end of this, there's the fellow in the shiny suit, and the big revelatory moment when Bones and Spock say, "We can't figure this out, man in the shiny suit." What seems to be here is an authentic manuscript of Johannes Brahms of music, and this seems to be a sculpture done by Michelangelo. He says, "Well, there's a reason for that, because I am Brahms."
That's right.
Because I am Michelangelo, because back in ancient Babylonia, I happened by random chance to have cells that were regenerating, and I was sort of an average guy. It's just that I learned a lot along the way, and, you know, after 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 years, I got pretty good at making statues and writing music.
So your heaven in a chip could be exactly that, heaven in a chip, or it could be hell in a chip.
Could be. Could be a constrained heaven in a chip. Could be a well-managed, well-regulated heaven in a chip. But the alternative, Art, is synaptic obliteration.
It is. Do you imagine, though, a time, given digital immortality, that an entity would choose itself, for any reason you can imagine, to be terminated?
Sure. And again, I'll cite the great Sir Arthur Clarke here. He has a famous novella called The City in the Stars. It takes place a billion years from now. We've been to the stars, come back, we're bored with that. And people basically are information patterns. They get tired of it, and they go into the blue flames and, in effect, upload and wait for another time. That could happen. But this is what it ought to be. Death should be purely voluntary. No coercion, no duress. And we live under duress now. As you get older, it gets worse by the day.
But would there not be infinite knowledge to be sought after?
Infinite's a tricky mathematical term, as you know. But practically speaking, huge amounts of knowledge that to us would seem infinite. Sure. I mean, wouldn't you like to read a few thousand more books and see a few thousand more movies? And that's just the beginning of it. It's just on this earth today as we know it. We have such a short lifespan. We sample so few things out there now. I mean, how many people have been to more than five countries? It's a small number.
Would a separated intellect miss the physical body? Would we suffer the, at first at least, and for a while, the missing limb syndrome?
Could be, yeah. Would you miss those toothaches and those pains? And I think, you know, Art, you would, number one, have the ability to continue the illusion of the body. Remember, the brain sits up there, and all these signals come up an imperfect pipe from the spine fed in. We can replicate that if you want. Or I would suspect, if you want to go the old-fashioned way, maybe again for entertainment's sake, you could go back in all slow me time and slog around under gravity as this big, lumbering, reproducing machine. But that, again, should be something of pure choice.
All right. Let me quickly, we're going to go to calls here shortly. I just want to grab one on our international line. Where are you calling from, please?
Yes, this is Thomas from Rosarito Beach, Mexico.
Mexico. How you doing?
I'm doing pretty good.
Okay. Well, you're on the air with Professor Cusco.
Oh, great. Actually, I'm not really calling for that. I'm actually calling about a UFO sighting down here.
Well, actually, we're not taking that. You mean right now?
Right now. There's been 20 flights.
Professor, hold on just a moment. What are you seeing, please?
We're seeing, like, Big Dipper formation. We've seen over 25 flights of these. 25 so far? 25 flights. They're moving at about a little bit faster than satellites do. They look like satellites, but there are no flashing lights at all.
And they're moving in a formation of some sort?
They're moving in a formation that looks like Big Dipper, but there's one after another, and they're all kind of going at different trajectories.
At what apparent speed?
Let's see. They're crossing from about from our northern view to our southern view about 7 minutes. So more.
So they're moving south then.
Uh huh. They are moving south mostly southeast.
All right. Then it would not be of value for people here in the U.S. to run out and try to get a look.
Oh, definitely in San Diego they could.
San Diego. All right. San Diego, take a look to your south, right?
Uh huh. North to south.
All right, sir. I appreciate the report. Thank you. I'm sure we'll get more.
Thank you very much.
All right, take care. How about that, Professor? Gee,
sure.
We speak.
I'm looking out my window. I'm in L.A. I don't see it.
Well, I'm sure the light pollution there in L.A. is going to stop you. Yeah, I didn't even know you were in L.A. That's where you are, huh?
USC, correct.
You're at USC.
I'm home now, but University of Southern California.
Do you teach all this?
Well, I teach the technology behind it. For example, tonight I gave a lecture on smart machines, on neural networks, on the nature of memory and learning. So the answer is yes.
Yes. Do you get the same kinds of questions and that you've been getting from me tonight?
No, I don't, and it's too bad that I don't. Probably because there's just so much to learn. You know, each year we cram more material into a technological advanced degree or undergraduate degree, and people are just often too busy to raise these issues.
How do you design a child that's 40% yours, 40% your spouse's, and 20%, who knows, somebody else's?
You can do it by realizing that what you are is one little point, like on a big sheet of paper, and that's your point in what we call genome space. And your mom and dad are two other points, and you lie right in the line between those two. And if we were to move your point a little bit, we can have any mathematical combination possible. So I think it's quite reasonable to expect that people will want to mix their genes, and, you know, with the pop star or the televangelist of the day, there'll be legal issues of identity here. So a real issue arises, Art. I mean, if somebody says, I want to have Art Bell's child, and a man and wife say, yeah, we've got three kids, let's have the fourth kid, and let's put in something that's 40%. Someone released Art's genome on the net. In theory, you can work out the mathematics, if not with today's computers, maybe in 10, 15, 20 years. And you've got a real question of privacy invasion.
What do you mean somebody releases my genome on the net? Is that going to be possible?
Well, I think a lot of us will carry more and more of our biological information on a credit card. It's easy to get that. Anything in a public database is subject to exploitation, especially to public figures. You bet you it could happen.
But I'd feel so violated.
Yeah. Well, this is, you're touching on the deeper issue of, you know, we have these ancient laws. Some are being adapted, like a case of spam email, but we're really not catching up to the digital technology in terms of privacy.
All right. You good to go for another hour?
You bet.
All right. Stay right there. Professor Bart Cusco is my guest. Good morning.
You're listening to Art Bell Somewhere in Time on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from April 4th, 2001. Bell Somewhere in Time on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from April 4th, 2001.
Professor Bart Cusco is here, and we're talking about his book, Heaven in a Chip, or is it Hell in a Chip? I really don't know. I guess that's part of what we're talking about tonight. It certainly could be heaven, but it also certainly could be hell. Back now to Professor Cusco, Bart Cusco. Welcome back.
Good to be back.
There are a lot of people that want to talk to you and ask questions, but I have one first. And this one, no doubt, comes from a... See, we're all products of what we read, our environment, our television, everything you were saying earlier. And I remember a movie in which somebody decided to view a person's death. Now, wouldn't that be high on the list of things if you had the ability to actually experience and view, but experience precisely what that person experienced, then the moment of death would be of high interest to a lot of people?
Yes, it would. I think it would create a new kind of extreme sport.
Well, I mean, I would imagine that you would think that the moment of death would be fade to black, right?
Well, but remember, though, Art, by definition, you have no sensory ability, so it cuts off before that. You know, have you ever been to the dentist or something, you've been knocked out?
Yes.
You're waiting for the operation, and next thing you know, you're waking up in pain. You never experience the absence of sensation.
Well,
people
no, there's no, there, a little fuzzy logic applies here. In other words, the process of death is not instant, is it? In some cases, I mean, you could be hit by a truck or something, but aside from that, a lot of deaths are not instantaneous. They are perhaps even agonizing. We don't know past a certain point what somebody experiences, right?
We can make some educated guesses, but you're right. There's often a flickering light there at the end.
Yeah, a little fuzzy logic there at the end. And so that would be an interesting thing to view. Would it surprise you if, in viewing that, you went through the darkness and came out on some other side? I guess that would really surprise you, wouldn't it?
It would surprise me to no end.
Would it
surprise the bejesus out of me.
Yes, I'm sure it would. Would it cause you to give up pursuing this technology?
It might. I'm not sure.
Oh, isn't
why
that interesting?
I'm not sure why that should happen. I mean, at the same time, Art, if I turned around and a biblical prophet walked up to me and could prove that, I think I would probably become a priest overnight. That's pretty powerful evidence.
Yes. Yes, it is. But you would pursue experiencing that moment.
Yeah, I think you would. I think we're all fascinated by the end. By the way, I want to just point out there's a famous story by Robert Heinlein, the science fiction author. In fact, his first sold short story called Lifeline, about a man who devises a technology. In principle, it's possible that just we have something called the leaky cable equation. If there's a leak in a telephone cable in the ocean, you can send electrical signal through it and find out where the leak is, and the ships go out and fix it. He used that with the principle of the general relativity, and you're kind of a big pink worm in space-time. You can hook your birth and your death, and you could send a signal down, and he would sell you the answer to when you would die and how, and the story proceeds from there.
All right, I want to get to a few calls now, so here we go. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Professor Cosco. Hi.
Hello, Art.
Hello.
And hello, Professor.
Hi.
This thing raises many questions. I've been thinking about it a long time, and it raises questions both for the individual and our society. One thing I really question is whether our society anytime in the near future could even cope with this. I mean, if you had people living hundreds of times longer than they do now and still would be in possession of their assets and they might want a place to live physically and stuff, where would you put all of these people?
That's a standard concern about cryonics and in general about life extension. And there's several things to say. The first one is there's a lot more land out there than people realize. Let me give you some quick back-of-the-napkin numbers. If you took all the people today on the planet and gave them all a city lot or a housing lot, they would all fit in the state of Texas. Give everybody a complete acre, and they fit comfortably within Australia. You may not like that kind of density.
Well, yeah, that might not be exactly a very acceptable lifestyle for some people, though.
It may not be. The other thing that a lot of futurists, I think, have seen here, I think it's inevitable, is even if we were to continue these accelerated rates of growth, we ultimately spread out, and not just to the nearby planets, but between in high Earth orbit and elsewhere, taking advantage of a lot of excess mass flying around up there in the skies and in the heavens, and convert that into big diamond-shielded bubbles in which we have our own greenhouses and universes. If you look at it in that sense, you got to remember we're talking volumes. And not
right. We would almost have to have habitats or something. Because I
but
think
my point I'm making is you can't. It would take trillions and trillions of people to crowd that space in any interesting way.
Well, like I said, I question whether our society could make that transition. Let me ask you another question.
By the way, we survived the Springer Show. I think we couldn't survive that.
Yeah, let me ask you another question. You know, we have normal people right now. The brain's kind of a delicately balanced mechanism. We have people now that go through wars and come back with traumatic stress, even though they're young people in their 20s and their bodies are perfectly functional. But they go through psychosis and they're never the same. I really question whether I'd want to continue living if I had only a mechanical body. That's one thing. I don't know what, I don't know how you would replace all the quantum effects of a physical body. But I question whether trying to transition a physical body into a mechanical body, whether the brain wouldn't be tipped into such a psychosis it could not survive.
Well, I assume if you didn't do the operation right. But, again, we are mechanical bodies, biomechanical bodies perhaps. And if you did this operation delicately, Art and I talked earlier about transferring up a chunk at a time to the chip, you could make it up there smoothly. You could certainly botch the procedure. But there's nothing in principle here. There's nothing in principle here that says the procedure should fail. And, you know, for example, we're not violating the speed of light and anything like that. All such complicated procedures, you know, have a risk associated with them, and we hope those will be intelligently managed at the time. And what's hard here is trying to envision a snapshot in the future. Of course, that would shock us today. But we get on these things a step at a time.
All right. Thank you, caller. Wouldn't a snapshot of our future, that future, which you imagine, include traditional reproduction virtually disappearing?
I don't know, Art. I think a lot of people would still want to continue to do it the old-fashioned way. I think there'll be a complicated mix. I do think what will be different, though, is there'll be a lot of people walking around that don't look like people today. They will have so manipulated their genome that they may be merged. They may have multiple organs, sense organs, or others. And that's all within the realm of genomic possibility, just as we understand the principles of genomes today. So it's not the crucial thing is this. Someone 100 years ago, projecting ahead, would have imagined very fast horse-drawn buggies on freeways. You know, it just didn't work out that way.
But, Professor, maybe we can't draw the analogy because the times will be different, but not much has changed in mankind's reign so far, and we've had wars over differences far smaller than the ones you just described.
Correct.
So wouldn't traditional human beings fear, loathe, ultimately kill anything that different?
Well, that's a good question. I think the first order, they would demand that the governments regulate it, as we're seeing now with the case of simple cloning and for fertility. At the first blush, Art, I think there'll be great fear and reaction to any of these kinds of technology. But on the other hand, it moves in step by fuzzy step. And so when we see the technology giving sight back to the blinded, boosting grandmother's IQ after she was suffering from Alzheimer's,
yes,
letting people with spinal damage walk, and there's a lot of work being done on that right now to repair the neural junctions there, you're going to feel very differently about it. And if you did it in one fell swoop, yes, but I just think we're going to get there by very comfortable fuzzy degrees.
Well, I don't know. We're at kind of a fuzzy junction right now with cloning, for example. Cloning is suddenly upon us as a society.
The animal kingdom. We've been in the plant kingdom for a long time.
Yes, but we're getting close. As a matter of fact, the Raelians that I told you about that are going to clone, they were sitting in front of Congress the other day trying to explain why government should not make any regulation with regard to cloning. Would you support that?
That's a tricky question. I mean, there's always the issue of external effects and liability.
I specialize in tricky questions.
That's good. Yeah, that's good. But to first order, this is still an issue of somebody's reproduction. So you want to make anybody who creates one or 50 children fully legally responsible in a family court kind of way for those offspring. The trouble with any new technology is it's possible, like with mass manufacturing of medicines, to make a mistake and cause great harm. The law has dealt with that through product liability. And in extreme cases, what are called ultra-hazardous activities through strict liability. And I suspect for quite a while, any kind of cloning efforts that proceed will be under the legal banner of strict liability.
And well, but you're saying we're going to get some of this exotic stuff by 2020, 2030. That's not that far away.
Not that far.
Cloning right now is suddenly upon us,
right,
and we hardly know how to handle it, whether to legislate, not legislate, leave it alone, regulate it. We don't know what to do with it right now.
The post office felt about email 10 years ago.
Yeah, that's right. Well, we're going to have other moments like that as we go to 2020 and 2030, right?
Absolutely.
Not such fuzzy moments.
My point is, I think we can take our existing legal system and adapt that. Just think about the legal system of 100 years ago adapted to the computer industry. Did it just fine? Yeah, there were a lot of cases and so forth, but it made it just fine. And I don't think it will be that much different here. There's nothing in principle different about bringing someone into being through sex the old-fashioned way or through in vitro fertilization, a variety of other techniques, and that shades into cloning. Probabilities or possibilities of damage are a different matter, and the law has traditionally dealt with that in terms of expanding the sphere of liability.
Yes, but we're not that far away from the ability to improve human beings. The genome is now unraveled, I'm told. And the next step, of course, is the manipulation of the genome, and then you can begin to improve human beings.
Sure.
And then when you have improved human beings, you have a problem.
Why?
Well, because you have, regular human beings, and you have improved human beings, and they're not going to like each other.
They may not. I think the trouble is the unforeseen accident. I'm trying to allow for that with a technology we don't understand. This has always been the problem. It's going to continue to be the problem deep into this century and next as technologies become more powerful.
I've talked to scientists, professor, about cloning, and they admit there are going to be some monsters. There are going to be some mistakes, and some of them are going to live. And they have deep questions about proceeding with human cloning based on that.
That's a fair point. Just as the ability to keep more fetuses alive have led to, in other nutrition things, to the children being born who might otherwise have died, the issue here, Art, is who assumes the risk. And if somebody's doing and imposing those risks on third parties, then I think there's a legitimate role for the state or whatever the future of that role is, that entity is, to make sure those who reap the benefits also pay the cost. And liability has been the way. We've come a long way. We've had a reasonably safe nuclear power industry, not here in California, and we have blackouts to show for it. But France is 70% nuclear. Japan and all of its earthquake is 50% nuclear, done pretty well. Those are scary technologies. I think, frankly, far more scary than cloning. They've done intelligently and step at a time. They've been manageable.
Well, manageable maybe, but if you live here in Nevada where I am, there's this little problem of all the waste from these nuclear plants that they're going to begin trucking into the side of a mountain where it's going to have to be kept safely for tens of thousands.
I've been out there. Yeah, come out, yeah.
Yes, yes. Well, so we feel a little disturbed about that out here. First-time caller line, you're on the air with Professor Cosco. Hello.
Hello.
Hello, you're on the air, sir.
Hi, how are you doing?
All right.
Art, you should be on 7 days a week, 24 hours a day.
Well, they'll get me in a machine if they can, and then, anyway, go ahead, sir.
I've got a couple of comments and one question. Professor, it sounds like you know, you're, with the external senses, you're internalizing them, you know, the five senses that you do have. And it sounds like that you're postulating the self as a hegemony.
What I said is that the self, the current model that consists of a lot of neural circuits competing for control. For example, if you look at an image and there's an apple in the image, and you say, now focus on that apple. And you can do that. You can say you were looking at it before, but you didn't really pay attention. How does one pay attention? We now know that's brought about by, in effect, one neural circuit winning out in the competition versus the others. And that seems to be the basis of this illusion of consciousness.
Well, it sounds like you're putting the physical hierarchy through a fuzzy logic circuit.
Well, it doesn't have to be a fuzzy logic circuit, but they are, in fact, neural circuits.
Well, I mean a fuzzy logic circuit in the way that the most insistent comes to the fore.
As you're saying, there is a competition, and whoever gets the biggest stimulation tends to win the competition, which is, by the way, exactly how our eyes work and processing retinal data that comes in. These are called lateral inhibition networks.
Mm-hmm.
If you just look at, just take that case, so if you look at the eye and a signal, whatever you're looking at right now, the signals are bombarding your retina, light, and it's getting transduced into electricity through some neural filters. Goes up the optic,
all that.
Right, and then it goes through layer upon layer of neural network filters. And we still don't know really what's going on there. We have a rough sense. It goes through the thalamus. It goes all the way back to area 17 of the brain where this illusion of the visual object is reconstructed. You know, it takes about a quarter of your brain to do visual processing. But, man, there are an awful lot of not just filters but feedback loops and back and forth. And it we can capture that now in terms of groups of neurons interacting. It's not that your grandmother's memory, your memory of your grandmother is stored in a particular cell. It's distributed out in these different fields. And they do compete. It turns out in biology, just as in neural network biology, just as in economic competition, that the organizing principle is competition. And you're right, that whoever tends to get the biggest stimulation wins. And moreover, we think what's going on is the neurons, a group of neurons, trying to predict a reward stimulus, maybe in the form of dopamine, is the current theory.
Well, one question, though. Yeah. When do machines get awareness, self-awareness?
Well, how about when they get natural language and abuse it like you and I do?
No, but I mean, the thing is, if I'm taking your postulation, and I'm saying, okay, a machine or a computer, whatever, if the mind can be downloaded or uploaded into a machine, then why not a machine having the ability to attain consciousness because of the fact that we can put the human intellect into a machine or the human awareness.
It would have the same illusion of consciousness that you and I have.
Now,
let me, if I can, cite the great... Scottish philosopher David Hume, who opened this up for us in the West. So Buddhists and Hindus were looking at this for thousands of years, a couple hundred years anyway, in the Far East. And that is, Hume said, whenever I look inward at myself, all I see is a perception and nothing but a perception. Therefore, I'm nothing but a bundle of perceptions. I'm the central repository of signals flowing in. And evidence today bears Hume out.
Professor Daniel up in Wisconsin asks, you know, your guest sounds as though he's studied Buddhism. As a Buddhist myself, he sounds like he's given up on what we can do naturally in favor of technology. Our brains just need to be reprogrammed.
Well, he's right. I have studied Buddhism. I have great respect for that. And of all the classical religions, I think it is, for me, the most reasonable, although I can't subscribe to an organized religion. And don't forget, the Buddha, so far as we know, was an atheist. And he had a very different view. But the Buddha, in the end, had a very simple argument. He said, look, the world is full of suffering, as it plainly is. Life is suffering. Dukkha is, I believe, the Sanskrit word for that. And he had a simple solution. That is, it comes from desire. And if you're worried about losing your life or the life of a loved one, here's a simple solution. Quit worrying. Don't value your life. It's kind of a cop-out answer. It's very clever. And what it really is, though, Art, it's Buddhism is not a religion per se in terms of spiritualism. It's a kind of intellectual pain pill.
Mm-hmm.
And we have better pain pills now. We're going to have much better ones. But in the end, when you're up on that fuzzy boundary of life and death, and you're looking at the last moments, I think Buddhism is something to consider.
So you think there would be a lot of foxhole Buddhists?
Absolutely.
Professor, hold on. We're at the bottom of the hour, so we'll be right back. My guest is Professor Bart Kosko. His book is Heaven in a Chip, and before I forget about it, as we come back from the break, we're going to tell you exactly how to get this book and any others that he has written, but particularly Heaven in a Chip. Sounds to me like you ought to be doing some reading on this subject because it sounds inevitable, doesn't it? This is Coast to Coast AM.
You're listening to Art Bell Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from April 4th, 2001. Somewhere in Time, tonight featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from April 4th, 2001.
My guest is Professor Bart Kosko, and we're talking about his book, Heaven in a Chip. That's right, Heaven in a Chip. Whether or not it's heaven depends, I guess, on your perspective. Though none of us have yet tried it, we know it's coming. We'll be right back. Just a couple of station-keeping notes here. I'm getting quite a few fast-blast messages of the following sort. From James in Palestine, Texas. Hey, Art, please tell everyone in Texas to get outside and see these things. Now, I got a call from Mexico indicating they were having some massive sightings there. Apparently, they're seeing these things, whatever they are, in Texas, too. So let's get as many eyes on this as we can. It appears to be a contemporary occurrence. In other words, whatever it is occurring right now. So I guess if you're in Texas, go take a look outside and see if you see a bunch of things moving in formation one direction or the other. I would guess to begin by looking south based on the other report. But take a good look around the sky in Texas, maybe New Mexico, border states. Let's see what you see. One other thing, as we get ready to go back to Professor Cosco, if you're outside the U.S., we've got a toll-free line for you. Try it. Whether you're in Europe or the Orient, South America, wherever you are, give it a try. There may be a sequence of numbers that you have to dial. You might check my website for those. And then our 800 number. Or you may just simply get hold of the AT&T operator and have her do it for you. But it's a free call no matter where in the world you are. The number is 800-893-0903. That's 800-893-0903 from any point in the world. All right, back now to Professor Cosco. Welcome back, Professor. Man, what a show. What a program. What a concept. What a thing to even consider.
It's been fun.
I guess it is. I guess it is fun. Let's go here. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Professor Cosco. Hello.
Hello?
Yes, hello.
Hi, I had a question for Dr. Cosco. What is your opinion of the concept of the brain as a receiver, as a quantum receiver for mind? And I had a comment after that, if that's okay.
Brain as a quantum receiver, well, my...
As presented by by Roger Penrose.
Ah, different story. But let me comment in general, then in specific.
Okay.
The idea of the brain as a quantum receiver, this reflects my colleague, Professor Steven Grossberg, one of the great unsung heroes of the mind. He's at Boston University. And he has said the brain is a measurement device operating at the quantum level. A measurement device operating at the quantum level. And the example, again, is if you're hit with a single photon of light, that's recorded in your brain and potentially encoded into your neural networks and possibly downloaded into those synapses. So in that sense, great things to be said for that. In terms of Professor Penrose's theory, this is a theory kind of trying to stick in the old classical linguistic notion of a free will and what are called microtubules. I don't think it makes sense on its face. I don't think he's worked out the information theoretic structure. Same kind of problem people have with souls. Well, what's the information compression mechanism here and the coding, decoding? But worst of all, there's been absolutely no evidence for it and no critical test proposed on how to refute the hypothesis.
Oh.
I think so far, so bad.
Mm-hmm. My comment would be that for me anyway, I know it doesn't hold any weight with you, but for me, it's a matter of experience that consciousness precedes materiality. And I suggest that experiences such as out-of-body experiences, past life remembrances, and direct conscious telepathy work against the claim of meat as creating consciousness.
Let me rebut that.
Okay.
I published in my book, Fuzzy Thinking, a mechanistic theory, a neural network-based theory of the sense of seeing the life flash before your eyes right before you have a traumatic accident. Now, there's been a tremendous amount of evidence of people reporting this experience,
mm-hmm.
and I don't want to deny that. But let's think about that for a minute. Why would it be the case? And we have a real easy way to explain that with neural networks. The basic idea is when you're in a tight spot, when the adrenal hormones flow, and you're in a fight-flight scenario, like seeing a Mack truck coming straight at you, we would expect the following, a massive search through your associative memory for anything that could save your butt.
Yeah.
The effect would be in your mind's eye, not of your life playing out in serial like a movie, but rather in a flash in parallel of similar incidents in your past that could have some probative value, some value in helping you find a solution to that problem. Mm-hmm. And so a psychological effect that is well documented can be explained in this case with simple neural circuits.
Well, I think that I have a motto for this sort of thing is that an infinitesimal amount of direct experience is worth an infinite amount of theory. And I remember about 50 lifetimes. I remember my last lifetime on this planet, which is about 10,000 years from now. And we will have one machine of, and this is just, you take it at whatever you feel like taking it as, but we'll have one machine on the planet, which will be a machine of loving grace, as they say. And it'll take the form of an old woman. An old woman who is basically our grandmother figure. There'll be about 40 people left of the planet. The whole planet is conscious.
Everyone's uploaded?
Only, the whole planet is conscious with one intelligence, a vast, almost omniscient consciousness as far as the planet is concerned, and yet it was extremely sad because it knew something was missing. So that's all I have to say.
All right. Well, I appreciate that, and I'm sure the old woman does, too. Scientists are really lousy at selling books, so I'm going to take time here, and we're going to sell your book. It's Heaven in a Chip. Now, I presume it's available nationwide?
Yes, it is.
It is. Is it in bookstores?
In bookstores, and I have a lot of books, Art, and Amazon.com or your website's the easiest way to go to get them. And if you want the hardcore stuff, I have textbooks, you know, with mathematics and problems in it. You can take a shot at it. If you're an instructor, you can even get a solutions manual.
My guess is, though, that a lot of the audience is going to want to read Heaven in a Chip.
Right.
It's designed, is it not? Not as a scientific paper, but it's written about, I guess it's a kind of future shock, right?
To some extent, and the text is straightforward. The footnotes are complicated, should you choose to explore that. And my website at USC, which people can access, has that as well. Also, again, for those looking for a little homework, you can download some recent technical papers that are there as well. But Heaven and Chip is by far the simplest way to get this and to see the vast literature on almost all the points that we've talked about. You'd be surprised how many scientists have covered this ground well.
Okay, well, off you go again. It's available on Amazon.com through my website. We've got a link, obviously. But how about an 800 number? Do you have one of those?
No, I don't.
You don't have an 800 number. Wow, you really are futuristic.
I'm trusting Random House here. So it'd be a great risk.
So we point everybody then at Amazon.com, where you get a really cool discount. Until someday they can't afford it anymore and they got to have business. Right now, though, Amazon.com will sell it to you very inexpensive. How much is it?
I think it's around $14. Quality paperback now.
Wow. $14. All right. Amazon.com, folks. Go to my website. Go to tonight's guest info, and there'll be a trail to buy the book right there. And I can't imagine you wouldn't. Now, here's something that I want to bring up with you, Professor.
Mm-hmm.
I've interviewed another man that a lot of people love to hate, whose name is Matthew Alper. And I want to discuss what he believes with you for a second.
Sure.
He says that mankind has always worshipped something, a god, the sun. If you go and you find a tribe in the deepest, darkest Amazon that nobody has ever been around before, they probably worship the sun. They worship something, that mankind always will worship something, that mankind's greatest fear is the fear of death. And to assuage that fear, our brains, as a matter of continuing evolution, have concocted what Matthew Alper calls a God part of the brain, a part of the brain that demands worship, demands a belief in the afterlife. I have this feeling that you might agree with that probability.
Yes, I do. And several points there. The crucial one is whether there's some genetic basis for the uniform belief in religion. Let's look at the evidence. All right. At the beginning of the 20th century, with men like Bertrand Russell and all the scientists coming and rediscovering mathematics and the results of Einstein and quantum mechanics, there was a feeling among scientists that science would kill religion.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at the evidence, it didn't. In fact, religion is stronger now more than ever. I mean, it was communism that fell, and the Falun Gong is working its way through China. It is something that, for better or for worse, it's there in a deep way. The question is why. I think you can make a case for a genetic basis. No question the fear of death. But I think that the better answer, the broader answer, is that we have in us evolved genes for obedience to authority, to salute up the chain of command. And this is the kind of way of doing that, salute up to the chain of command of religion or the state, and usually very closely coupled throughout history, maybe not so much in this country. But even, you know, look at the Taliban blowing up those Buddhas in Afghanistan. And the question you would ask is why, and the usual answer is that even a brutal system can stabilize a hierarchy, and somebody in a hunter-gatherer scenario doesn't want to stop, and if you ask Woody Allen-like existential questions, he's more likely to get eaten by the beast than to eat the beast and not pass on his genes. So I think you can make a case that we have obedience to authority. I mean, I'll give you another example that really disturbs a lot of us who are fans of Thomas Jefferson. People talk about the president running the country,
mm-hmm.
and having things like drug czars and now a faith czar. You know, this concept of a king or a czar comes from Caesar. People and the media love to personify complex political processes in one person, whether it's Ronald Reagan or Bill Clinton or whoever. there is a sense to have a visible, palpable leader. There is a real will to follow.
Mm-hmm.
And it has to have a genetic basis.
Dave asks, and maybe it's a good moment for it, why are 99% of scientists nihilists with no ethics nor morals?
Well, I don't know, because that's not true. But what we do know is that a study taken about 100 years ago found, to the shock of polite Victorian society, that only 40% of scientists profess belief in a god or afterlife. And then the same study taken about 5 years ago also shocked folks, because it's the same number. Still about only 40% of scientists believe in that, and people thought it was much lower. So, but the majority, a good number of scientists maintain these beliefs. I'm not one of them, but there's a good number who do.
Well, one would imagine that Mr. Alper's scenarios good pretty much across the board, and that would include scientists as well. They all have families. They all have loved ones. They all have hopes for some sort of conscious continuation.
Mm-hmm.
And you think the best bet for that is in a chip.
Chip, and as a backup of chronic. So let me say one other thing, looking at the data on this. If you look at the scientists polled about of those who are most skeptical and those who are most believers, the most skeptical are biologists who kind of work with flesh and Darwin, and the least skeptical, the most fanciful in terms of religion, are mathematicians.
All right. First-time caller line, you are on the air with Professor Cusco. Good morning.
Hi, this is Charlie in Seattle, and I got a question and a comment for Professor Bart.
All right.
He was talking about cloning a little while ago, and I wanted to ask him, if I was to clone you, Professor, would your clone have the same soul as you?
Well, it would have the same psychic capacity and behavioral capacity, I think, that you call the soul. Remember, these are terms of art, or terms of last resort, terms like soul and mind. We try to define them. We can't. We give some behavioral attributes. We don't really have it. It's the same thing, again, in miniature. If we look at the watch, and the watch stops moving, and where did the motion go? This kind of animism projected. But don't forget, if you really had a soul, you got a big problem, because it doesn't obey laws. A ghost in a machine is a very dangerous thing.
Okay, and you guys were talking about just now about how they worship the gods back when mankind started, I guess.
Yes.
And what I find weird is, like, way back, they started out like worshiping a bunch of gods, and up till now, it narrowed down to one god.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's kind of an efficiency there.
What's that?
There is a kind of efficiency, a kind of competitive influence among gods, and they coalesce into one. It's like many physical forces into one.
Yeah.
Monotheism has been the trend, that's right. Until
okay,
the New Age movement.
All right, thanks.
All right, thank you. Again, I'm getting reports from Janie in Edna, Texas. Art, there are a bunch of light balls flying near the coast. You can see them even with the street lights. Is there some sort of meteor shower tonight? There's kind of some kind of mass sighting going on in northern Mexico and the southern U.S. You might want to take a look. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Dr. Bart Cusco. Hi.
Good morning. Good morning, Art.
Yes, good morning.
It is, it's an honor to be on your show.
Thank you. Where are you?
I'm in Minneapolis, KSTP 1500.
All right.
And, it's a really honor, really amazing topic going on here.
Well, then, contribute. Do you have
a question? It reminds me of that movie Demolition Man. And, you know, it's kind of the perfect scenario. The guy gets woken up from the cryo freeze, and he's the same guy he was before. You know, he's perfectly intact. He can actually run after he's unfrozen.
Yes.
Which, is just completely unrealistic. And so,
is it, Doctor, completely unrealistic that you would be cryogenically frozen?
Cryonically.
Revived, I'm sorry, I'm never going to get that right. Cryonically frozen, and then 100, 200 years from now, revived, and whatever was wrong is now fixed. You're either uploaded or your body is now perpetually healthy. They've managed to do something about immortality.
Several things.
First, whatever.
In this movie, it's an interesting movie. Wesley Snipes is a bad guy, and he's frozen, and the cop goes after him, Sylvester Stallone. They both come back. But the caller is correct. I mean, it's unrealistic to think you'd pop right out and 5 minutes later resume where you left off.
Right.
But to your point, though, Art, whether you would have your old capabilities, remember this, though. Most of us think that the way it will work is if you save part of your tissue, like your brain, that will reclone the body from the head stump if you really want the body. And so it's not so much of keeping the little parts around, because after all, the kind of nanotechnology or molecular engineering you'll need to fix the eye's damage and do a lot of other things at the cell level for the brain, that it trivializes the science involved to grow a body back from the clonal, the DNA material.
isn't that going to be concurrently possible or even possible before the uploading of a brain, that is to say, growing a new arm, leg, liver, heart, individual organs?
I think for transplant it will, Art, but it, you know, if you lose your arm and want to see it kind of grow back versus 3 inches long and it grows out to the full size, I think that will take longer, and just because information is so efficient and working with matter and flesh is so relatively inefficient, that I would bet on the information technology happening first.
All right. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Professor Cosco. Good morning.
Yes. Hello, Art.
Hi.
Dr. Cosco.
Hi.
I started out with two questions, but I think you've already answered the first. It was a brief one, basically on your theological beliefs, but I believe I've heard enough to kind of get an idea there.
By the way, I can say everything about theology in two words: no evidence.
Yeah, thank you.
All right,
you.
And so therefore,
your second
question is?
Well, my second question was more of an essay question to let you kind of go off into the wild blue yonder. I was wondering what your thoughts were on the possibility of these, I believe you said, sugar cube-sized brain repositories or mind repositories, possibly being the start of a true diaspora where individuals could transfer into this with whatever kind of, you know, maybe possibly nuclear, who knows what, power source, small vessels, and spread in all directions from the Earth and basically explore, who knows, the universe.
I think you touched on a wonderful word, the diaspora, like the diaspora of the Jews. It took many thousand years to come back to Israel. I think that once we're, for example, doing time in a bottle in liquid nitrogen, whoever of you out there joined me and the thousands signed up to do that, we sort of are people without a home, without a country, maybe without a society. We are a great diaspora of nothing but suspended minds. And so once you bring them back in whatever form, information form, and you may very well not want to inhabit a body or bounce around up to Mars or have copies as backup on Mars or somewhere else, and that could over time look like a spread of almost a disease or some kind of new life form throughout the solar system, maybe beyond. You could certainly, for example, take the information in these chips and just shoot it up in a bit stream into deep space.
So maybe that's our key to eventual interstellar travel, eh?
Yeah.
Never thought about it that way. Well, lots of material to do another program. What a pleasure it has been to have you here. You've held up after a three-hour lecture and then coming on here and doing, what, a four-hour lecture virtually. You're holding up pretty well at this time of the morning. You must be a night person.
I typically am, yes. Art, it's been a lot of fun. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Good night, Doctor.
Good night.
Let me just take 1 second to mention that we have massive sightings, and I mean massive sightings going on during the program. In fact, right now, people are still seeing these things out across the entire Southwest U.S. Now, we are hampered here in the desert by, believe it or not, clouds. We have clouds out there. Damn it. So I'm going to depend on a lot of you out there to grab your cameras, grab your video cameras with night shot, grab whatever you've got that will capture the images and send them to me. And no doubt tomorrow night we'll have something of a discussion of what's been going on tonight. I'm a little sheltered in here, but I do have access to a lot of information, and I'm telling you, we've been getting hundreds of reports. So something's happening out there. We'll find out, no doubt, by tomorrow what it was. For tonight, I'm Art Bell. That's it from the high desert. Ta-ta.